Welcome to this special Think Tank edition of Colorectal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For some years, Dr. Rich Goldberg has co-chaired this annual post-ASCO festivity with me. And as with most of our recent investigator-closed roundtables, we asked the faculty to weave two elements into the discussion. First, a journal club focusing on the most clinically relevant journal articles and meeting presentations from the past year, and second, a series of mini-tumor panel discussions of de-identified patients from their practices. For a listing of the papers discussed, see the enclosed booklet or go to researchtopractice.com. As with our lung cancer think tank the prior July week, this colorectal extravaganza took place in our new sound studio in Miami, overlooking Biscayne Bay and South Miami Beach. With the faculty hopefully inspired rather than distracted, we began with a big story coming out of the recent ASCO meeting, Eric Van Cutsem's compelling meeting plenary presentation on the use of KRAS status to predict benefit from cetuximab plus chemotherapy in metastatic disease. Dr. Axel Grothe kicked off this segment with comments about how the KRAS assay has been developed in Europe.
Sometimes we can learn from other countries, and in Europe, panitumumab was approved in the context of KRAS wild-type patients last year. So they had to develop tests to, and they have to develop a whole program to allow us to select patients for these treatments. So what they did in Europe last year was trying to compare different tests, some of the tests developed by academic pathologies, molecular pathologies, some of them commercially available like DXS. And they had a very coordinated approach toward this, at least what I'm aware of in Germany. And they compared different tests developed in different universities and commercially available tests, and they found there was almost 100% concordance. Mutations, mutations, and mutations. So if you have a test that's reliable that can show you a mutation, it's not a level of cutoff that you're looking at. It's a yes or no decision. So it's actually very robust. And I do think the discussion should not be about which is the best test, whatever, because probably all tests are somewhat created equal, but how to implement them.
Dan?
I think the nice part of KRAS is it's a dichotomous test. It's a yes or no test. It's not like FISH testing in HER2 patients. Also, because the proportion of people who are mutants are a fairly large proportion, about 40% of patients, we're not talking about a very small subset. One point is when we're telling people they need to do this is, as I understand it, it's not a test that varies tremendously over time. So one question is, do you have to do it on every primary colon cancer, or can you simply wait until you're getting to the 10% of people who you're going to treat with an EGFR agent and then do it on archive tissue? I think it's a very practical issue for hospitals.
Lee?
So the nice thing about the RAS test, as my colleagues have pointed out, is that it's a black and white. It's very easy for the clinician to interpret. The sensitivity and specificity are probably above 96 or 97%, and that's a conservative estimate. The Lupakis study at ASCO demonstrated that KRAS mutation in the primary is representative of KRAS mutation in the metastasis, whereas other markers such as P10 are not. And one of the issues with immunohistochemistry, as other people have alluded to, is the fact that it's not a black and white, but there are also other tissues with fixation. Some of the things I learned by talking to Stan Hamilton is, even if you cut the slides and the slides sit for 2 to 3 weeks, it's something which was a surprise to me, the antigen recognition can go away. And this is in formalin-fixed paraffin-embedded slides that over time you will not be able to recognize certain antigens. And that may play a role in why we have some, quote, EGFR-negative tumors when biologically there are no such things as EGFR-negative colon cancers because all epithelial cells express EGFR. It's just our inability to detect it. So the mutational analysis is a black and white. It's very straightforward. The immunohistochemical analysis is fraught with all kinds of errors, starting from where the tumor biopsy was taken, how it was processed, and also how long ago the slides were cut. For KRAS mutation, if you go to the websites, and there's probably about 7 companies in the U.S. right now, in addition of multiple medical centers who will analyze tumors for KRAS, they ask you simply for 3 slides that you send to the company, and the turnaround time is about 8 to 10 days, telling you whether it's a black and white, it's KRAS mutated or KRAS wild type. So it's very simple.
Neil? One of the interesting things related to the readout of the test that my own pathologists have brought to my attention is that, in fact, there is heterogeneity molecularly within a colon cancer. And even within a colon cancer that has a population of cells that are RAS mutant, there are some cells, or there may be some, that are wild-type RAS. And the key here is to not be confused in making clinical decisions because, in fact, the studies upon which we are basing these clinical decisions did use a black and white yes-no readout, and it's important that that's how we actually interpret the results of the RAS testing, in spite of the heterogeneity that may exist within a given tumor.
So again, are you using KRAS right now off study to make decisions?
Absolutely.
And when did you start doing it?
I started routinely doing it after the data presented at ASCO and the robust discussion that took place at ASCO around the interpretation of those data.
Rich?
So Lee, I wanted to ask you a question about the test. As I understand it, there are multiple methods of doing the test. They're all essentially equally reliable. There's a small study that shows that. And the cost of doing the test in a research laboratory is actually modest,
true,
despite the fact that DSX and other vendors of the test are charging $400, $500, $600 per test. And while it may be worth it to avoid using a drug that costs $3,000 a month that's going to be ineffectual, do you have any comment about the mechanics of the testing and the cost of the testing?
I think a lot has to do with the CLIA certification of the test. For us to do a KRAS mutational analysis, it probably cost about $80. The initial fees for doing the test were estimated to be between $300 and $400. Now at MD Anderson for a patient, and we're not sure who's going to pay for it right now, but the charge to the patient or the insurance company is about $1,000 because you have to make sure that you have all your safeguards in place. You make sure it's reproducible. And at this early stage, I think you have to do a little bit more work because you are making patient decisions on a test that isn't yet CLIA approved. So we have to cover our tracks.
Jordan, can you present your patient?
64-year-old male with a history of hypertension. Presented originally in 2004 with sigmoid colon cancer, two liver mets. We resected him, gave him full Fox. He got neuropathy, so we stopped the Oxali a little early. And he did well until November 2006. Still has grade 2 neuropathy, in case you're curious. And when CEA increased and CT PET found new perihepatic metastases and other peritoneal implants, actually really is more a CT than his PET. But FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab was started in January of 07 with normalization of the CEA and improvement on CT. Then in November, we actually stopped the drug. His daughter was getting married. He didn't want to be on chemo. He had a great time, and actually since he wasn't progressing, we kept him off till March 2007 when he started rising. We put him back on with initially he had dropped in CEA, then he had Sable disease, very expensive for a disease. In July 2007, his CEA increased and CT showed progression. We just sent his tumor tissue off, and it's KRAS mutant, unfortunately.
Could you talk a little bit about the man himself? Does he go out and get information, or does he just say, Doc, what do I do?
He's actually a Doc, what do I do guy, but he's sweeter than heck. He's most interested in his family right now. He's a sweet guy.
What's his impression or what's his reaction been to what's been going on here? It sounds like he's done better than maybe he might have expected.
He's kind of gotten in that mode that a lot of these long-termers get in, that they're no longer afraid or worried about the cancer as much. Or
at really?
Least that's what I'm seeing. I don't know. But I mean, maybe he's just got a great attitude about life. But he said, well, let me know what comes up. I haven't given him the results of the test, but he knows what the two options will be.
So you actually talked to him about the fact that you were going to get this KRAS test?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And what are you thinking right now at this point in terms of what you might do? Are you convinced enough that there's no way you're going to use the cetuximab?
Oh, yeah. I'm convinced he's going to go on either a phase one specific colon or just a general phase one.
Did you present him or are you going to present to him a non-research option?
I don't know a non-research option. He has neuropathy, so I can't put him on oxaliplatin.
Let's say he can't go in the study, he doesn't want to go in the study. What would you be thinking about doing?
I would take care of him the best I know how.
Without systemic therapy?
No, because some people do capecitabine, which is completely silly. The MD Anderson people show there was no response to capecitabine after first-line therapy. He's been through therapies for years now. So actually, he was originally resected with stage 3 disease in reality, and he's been through 5 of you a lot in life. So,
I mean, is he symptomatic from the tumor?
Yeah, actually he is now.
What kind of symptoms is he?
The peripatic metastases are invading the capsule and causing capsular pain.
What's his lifestyle like? Is he?
Oh, he's fully active. I mean, he's on low doses of narcotics and he's fully active and he danced quite a bit at his daughter's wedding.
So are you thinking you would say to him, you know, if you don't go on a study, we'll just sort of sit things out and see what happens?
Yeah, I mean, that's
you think
what
he
I'm
would accept no anti-tumor therapy?
He may not like it, but I'm not sure giving therapy for the sake of psychotherapy isn't the right answer.
Axel?
So has anyone used these radioactive spheres in this context?
Well, this patient has peritoneal mets.
Yeah, but you said it's dominating liver and it's symptomatic.
But it's peri-hepatic. I mean, it's really invading into the liver.
Into the liver. Okay.
So you can put all the spheres into the hepatic blood supply you want, but they're not getting their blood supply from that.
I mean, do people really accept that? In this situation, no systemic
versus cetuximab rash for no benefit?
No, I mean, it makes sense logically. I'm just trying to put myself in the position of the patient.
Yeah, I think you've got to be very careful that having a problem doesn't mean you've got something useful to do. There's something old-fashioned called best supportive care, which is taking care of the patient, including all of their symptoms. The data for cetuximab and panitumumab in RAS mutated tumors, patients who don't benefit, there's data to suggest quality of life may not be as good because of the symptoms, while not formally. In addition, there's suggestion that patients do worse. So I think the presumption that you have to give chemo because when it's known to be inactive is a false assumption. There are going to be patients who may benefit from slowing their tumor growth. We need to figure out how to define that, particularly in the individual patient. But where the likelihood of not helping or actually hurting the patient is as big as the chance of helping, I think we need to resist the pressure to throw chemotherapy at a patient because we have nothing else to do for them.
Charlie?
Yeah, I would completely agree. I mean, this was sort of the anticipated but infrequently discussed issue of KRAS testing. That is, we're going to tell patients, I don't have a therapy for you. But that's not something we're unfamiliar with colon cancer or GI cancer in general. And I think I agree with the points made. Why give somebody a rash when the drug's not going to work? And honestly, you're talking about a drug that has modest activity in the best circumstance. And so to the extent, and I think that frequently my own sense in the community, at least in New England, is that there hasn't been terrific market penetration of cetuximab in its current line of therapy. And when it's being used in the community, it's frequently being used for a short duration. That is, there's a low threshold to stop it.
Dan?
What you're asking essentially reflects, I think, in part the subprime mortgage problem, is for the past decade or more, we had a relative proliferation of drugs, and our patients obviously are living longer. And we're all coming to the understanding that even though they do live longer, there does come a time where you just have run out of things to do. And we used to talk about the availability of all five drugs. Axel popularized that concept. With 40% of patients not being able to receive one, we're down to 4.6 drugs.
Alan, what about the trial that you're running? How did you respond to this emerging data? And what about the issue of off-protocol first-line therapy? Is now cetuximab with chemotherapy in a KRAS wild patient a consideration compared to, say, FOLFOX-BEV?
Right. So there are two issues. CLGB80405 is suspended at the moment to be amended to enroll all patients who are otherwise eligible to determine their KRAS status.
Could you review the design of the study?
The design is a physician-patient choice, FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, with three arms, cetuximab alone, bevacizumab alone, or the combination of the two. The study was suspended, just went through the Data Safety Monitoring Board at CALGB, where they looked at a variety of issues, including the rationale of continuing the double biologics, given some data that suggests the double biologics may not be likely to be beneficial. Their decision was that we should revise the study to only include wild-type KRAS tumors, but that the three arms would remain intact for the time being.
And Axel, what about the issue of decision-making now in the first-line setting? Is cetuximab chemo in KRAS wild patients a consideration as first-line therapy compared to, say, Bev with either, well, Bev FOLFOX probably?
When I look at the data that we have so far in first-line therapy, Opus and Crystal, so FOLFIRI and a FOLFOX backbone for cetuximab in the KRAS data, and I think for the majority of patients, the data are not convincing enough to really define the population that has this huge benefit from using cetuximab or perhaps even panitumumab in first-line therapy. But I do see, and I think they could emerge as one of those treatment options that I would use in this conversion therapy setting, meaning patient which has liver metastasis limited to the liver and needs a response, a strong response, to convert the tumor into resectability. And I think this is where a treatment like FOLFOX plus cetuximab or FOLFIRI plus cetuximab might be able to shine due to the high response rate observed in KRAS wild-type tumors. When we look at the FOLFOX plus minus cetuximab data in the OPUS trial, the addition of cetuximab to FOLFOX gave a 24% increase in response rate in KRAS wild-type. It actually is very similar to the trial that Alan presented, 8203, so where the impact of cetuximab on response was quite strong in the context of FOLFOX. So this patient population might be the one who could benefit from cetuximab first line.
Rich, we had your buddy Mark Sosinski here last week for the Lung Cancer Think Tank, and we were talking about, because now they're in the cetuximab world, and we were talking about the issue of the geographic thing that you and Jordan always talk about in these think tanks about reactions. Any updates on that? They were curious about, you know, what more we know about that.
Well, there actually is an update on that, and there is a test that is being developed, and I am told that it's going to be marketed in the fall, that will help to identify whether patients who have not been treated with cetuximab have the antibody that appears to cross-react with cetuximab.
What is this antibody? Do we know what it might be cross-reacting with?
And Jordan was on the paper.
Jordan?
Yes, we looked at this and found an IgE antibody to something. It's a glycoprotein that's actually attached to the molecule rather than an important part of the EGFR antibody itself. And we're not entirely sure what kind of exposure it is. A lot of us think it's plant or insect-borne or something like that because it doesn't seem to climb up the mountains. And whatever it is doesn't like it all the way up in the hills between Rich and I. But on either side, it's definitely there, and people are exposed. We found this in 21-point-something% of the people who have never been exposed, not patients, but just normal controls. And that's the exact same rate that we found on the paper that UNC and Vanderbilt did in JCO about the frequency.
But Jordan, is this IgE correlated with the reaction?
The IgE seems to correlate. I mean, we found it in the same group of people who'd had the reaction too, yeah.
So it's a tight correlation.
Yeah, it's very tight.
So based on the data you have, would you not treat somebody with cetuximab who has this presence of this antibody?
God, yes.
Would you use panitumumab?
Yeah. I mean, it's the alternative. So yeah, we actually wanted to do a prospective study of this. We were willing to at least look at the prospective study. We've not had any deaths, and we're concerned about the reaction, but we've had some pretty severe reactions. But if we don't end up being able to do a prospective study, which I think would be appropriate of the IgE test, then I still think the data is robust enough that I probably would use it. I don't know about Rich.
Is the test available now?
No.
Rich?
The test is not available yet, but should be shortly. We tend to use panitumumab for people that aren't going on study. We have a big investment in CLGB and cetuximab studies and esophagus and colon. But when we're not putting patients on study, we tend to use panitumumab because of the high frequency of reactions that we've seen.
And if the test were available right now, would you use it clinically off study?
Absolutely.
Lee, any markers coming out to add to our ability to predict response to systemic therapy in colorectal cancer?
There were several interesting presentations over the last couple of years at ASCO and the meetings in Barcelona. I think that KRAS is a black and white. P10 is a potentially good marker. P10 is not mutated in colon cancer. It's either expressed or expression is downregulated by epigenetic factors. And in talking to the pathologists about P10, the antibodies are not very good right now. So the reproducibility of P10 by immunohistochemistry is very poor. As far as the ligands are kind of interesting, but the way these were done were by gene array analysis and RT-PCR, and this is not a user-friendly platform looking at high levels of epiregulin or amphiregulin. And also the cutoff is somewhat arbitrary. So we don't have that black and white. You have some patients who may have very low levels of amphiregulin or epiregulin who will respond, and the opposite. So I really don't think that's going to add a lot of refinement above and beyond KRAS at this time. And I don't foresee that happening anytime in the near future. So I myself am not really pursuing expression of the ligands or P10. It's interesting biologically, but from a practical point of view, I don't think it's going to fit into our practice.
And from a pathways point of view, in my simple mind, my best understanding of this is somehow KRAS is downstream and then it sort of bypasses what's going on outside the cell?
Yeah, all the KRAS is downstream. So if you have an activated pathway downstream, inhibiting signaling at the cell surface isn't going to do anything. So that not only holds true for KRAS, but would also hold true for RAF, R-A-F, which is mutated anywhere from 2 to 5% of the time in colon cancer. So
it's the same one in melanoma?
It's the same.
It's a bigger player in melanoma?
The BRAF V600E mutation is a major player in melanoma. It does occur in colon cancer. Other RAF mutations occur in colon cancer. But as I said, it's a relatively small percentage, 2 to 5%.
Neil?
For clinical utility, in the ideal world, you have a black and white answer, yes or no. These are people who will not benefit 100% of the time. Don't give them therapy. And that's the gold standard, and that's what we're seeing with the RAS test. The utility of future tests that improve our discriminant ability in terms of classifying for response or non-response, the utility of those tests will be based not only on how well they discriminate, but also whether there's another option that you're choosing between. So, for example, the Genomic Health Group presented some data about a gene expression profile in the RAS wild-type patients at ASCO this year, where they used expression of four genes in an algorithm together to further stratify within the wild-type RAS group who is more or less likely to respond to cetuximab. And they were able to stratify a group that had a 15% chance of not having progression versus 85% chance. The question is, does that make a difference clinically? Because even with a 15% chance, you might still treat if you don't have another good option. So the utility in the clinic of these classifier tests for prediction of response to therapy is based not only on how good the test is at stratifying, but also whether there's another option.
That's interesting. We were talking about RT-PCR. I was going to ask, is, you know, genomic health involved? Because obviously in breast cancer, they're part of daily practice. Can you talk a little bit more about the different variants in terms of biologically what they mean?
With regard to KRAS, the question is there a change in a nucleotide that turns on the RAS protein constitutively so that it's always on? So the RAS gene results in translation of a RAS protein, and that protein is responsible for sending growth signals to the nucleus. Ordinarily, the protein's in the off state, and it requires signaling from above through a receptor on the surface of a cell to turn the RAS protein on, and then when it's turned on, when it's activated, it sends further signals towards the nucleus. In the setting of a RAS mutation, where the gene has an alteration in one of the nucleotides, that results in a protein that is always turned on. And so when that protein is turned on, sending signals, it doesn't matter what you do upstream at the surface of the cell, and that's why these tumors who have RAS gene mutations are not responding to therapy with an antibody that affects binding upstream of the ligand to the receptor.
Charlie?
Just related to Lee's comment about BRAF, I think that that may become far more interesting over the next year because we looked at it in about 600 colon cancer patients. It's mutated in about 15% of them, and we have some preliminary data suggesting that BRAF mutations do is the same thing that KRAS mutations do, which makes sense because BRAF is the immediate next step, and moreover, KRAS mutations and BRAF mutations are mutually exclusive. A colon cancer cell doesn't choose to mutate both because there's no reason. You either activate the pathway by mutating KRAS or you activate the pathway by mutating BRAF. So what I would suggest is that we may find in the coming year that testing for both mutations may define not 40% of patients who won't get cetuximab, but maybe 50 to 55%.
Rich?
I just wanted to make a comment in praise of the Colon Cancer Task Force, which Neil Maripol runs, which evaluated this KRAS data with respect to the adjuvant therapy and the advanced disease studies that are ongoing, determined that the KRAS testing was reliable, that it appeared to be prognostic, and closed all three studies, the adjuvant study, the first-line study, and the second-line study, in order to incorporate KRAS testing in the eligibility. And so I think that that provides an unambiguous message that the people who are in the cooperative groups representing the colon cancer groups feel that this is an important finding and that it should modify not just clinical practice, but the way we design clinical trials.
Axel?
I think the major difference is we're talking about different mindset. We're talking about not kind of exposing patients to all drugs on a very empiric basis. We're starting to think more like breast cancer doctors, more like molecular pathologists, molecular oncologists. And I think this will lead to a leap in the quality of our trial designs and hopefully the quality of our treatment.
The original work published by Bert Vogelstein and Eric Fearon, which was classic work in 1988 and 1990, where they published the Vogelgram showing the sequence of genetic mutations that occurs in colon cancer, KRAS was listed as one of the earliest mutations. Now, it's important to put that in the context because only 40% of tumors will actually have a KRAS mutation. As Charlie pointed out, there are other mutations which are becoming much more cognizant of the other mutations that can occur. But KRAS is an important driver of tumorigenesis. It's been found in multiple transgenic models that you have to have a mutated KRAS in order to convert a normal cell to a malignant cell, along with other molecular changes. But KRAS appears to be the dominant factor in converting a normal cell to a malignant cell, at least in preclinical transgenic models.
And actually, Alan, last week in the lung think tank, there was a lot of discussion about the colon data in KRAS because they don't have that data, but you know they suspect it'll play out the same way. Do you think, Alan, it's going to play out that way in lung, for example?
Well, I'm not sure one size fits all, but I think it certainly... I've been asked the question, what if the cartoons that we draw and these findings were contrary to one another? In other words, this is the pathway, and would we accept this if it was contrary to the cartoon representation? And I think that's a very good point. All this makes sense, and so we tend to accept it, and it should apply to other tumors, you'd think. One comment I was going to make, in a way, it is striking how we've moved the field in 6 months. The problem is the FDA is still well behind us. And so they have still not approved nor authorized a test for KRAS. And so there are issues for whether insurers will cover the KRAS test. And so this is where the field has moved, but in fact, the regulatory bodies are lagging.
Well, this actually comes up a lot in breast cancer. And Dan, there were some really provocative articles in the JCO in terms of breast cancer about FDA approval of Oncotype versus MammaPrint. And the breast people were saying, well, the FDA is really not, it's not the same thing with the test as it is with the drug. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's always difficult when one is dealing with the science, a regulatory body, and industry. And I think that's what's happening a little bit here, is that the regulatory bodies are behind both the scientific groups and industry, and that needs to be fixed. One comment I can make in regard to what Rich said is that I think for people who are listening to this, they all know that we take care of patients just like they do, except we're spoiled because we're kind of idiot savants who see mostly GI cancer. And most folks who take care of lots of patients, I'm happy I don't work on the NCCN guidelines because I can't even begin to think of how I would write a standard program for how to take care of metastatic colon cancer in 2008. It has now become so complicated. So these programs are even more important to let people know, number one, it's not as monolithic as it was even 2 or 3 years ago. And I think we need to begin to develop new paradigms on how to approach patients, not just based on biology, but on what we've learned about the complexity of the disease.
Let's talk about the other major biologic strategy in colorectal cancer, bevacizumab, and the continuing evolution of data coming out of registries looking at how this agent's used in practice. Herb, can you comment on the so-called First Beat study that was presented at ASCO? This is an international prospective observational study of patients receiving Bev for metastatic disease with a variety of chemo regimens. The data reminded me a lot of Axel's Bright data that previously had shown the same or maybe even less incidence of hypertension, proteinuria, bowel perforation, arterial vents, and wound problems in clinical practice.
Yes, so the good news is that the data from the clinical trial data set seems to be reflected when the drug is used in clinical practice. That there are always some caveats to that, but the good news is that generally, while clinical practice is traditionally thought to not necessarily reflect the skill level of care for patients in a clinical trial, or that the patients themselves were of better performance status and more selected, there are some other issues why registry data can often look favorable and why this data may look good. One is the sites selected for this registry were generally large, good private practices or even university-based practices. This does represent an experience of patients who are not heavily selected. So this will be much more in all comers. But again, with experienced clinicians, there'll be a tendency not to treat people where treatment would otherwise be inappropriate. And the other thing which may help is, with time, people learn how to use drugs better and how to select patients a little better. And while some of these may be relatively nuanced, some may be obvious, I think it is good news that in general, the learning curve for people learning how to use a new therapy, including alternating the platform chemotherapy, mean that in general, people can learn fairly well, and the toxicity rates are low enough that the key decision, at least for first-line colon cancer, can be based on efficacy, not necessarily toxicity management, at least with respect to bevacizumab.
The question that I hear the most in general from oncologists is what to tell patients and how to select people in terms of arterial venous events. That seems a little more cloudy in terms of predicting people who might be at higher risk. What do we know about that today?
Yeah, so only a little bit is known that wasn't known before. The first issue is that patients who would be at high risk, by protocol criteria, that would be having an event within a year, and by common sense criteria, that actually seems like a pretty good number. There's always the caveat of, did the patient have an intervention, get revascularized, and may actually be better off than they were before?
What about the tumor itself? You know, a patient who's in a desperate situation, does that make you sort of fudge a little on that?
Probably not much. I think a big issue is going to be what's their real risk status, and then you can extrapolate to what's the risk-benefit for the patient. The closest way to get at the risk-benefit ratio was there was an analysis of a couple studies that were grouped together related to cardiovascular risk. And if you take all comers, the rate is about 1% per year in the control group, and about 1.5% to 2% in those patients who got regular chemo plus bevacizumab, or about a twofold increase for an overall study population. If you then look at patient groups who might be a little bit higher risk, age over 65, then the risk goes up from about 4% to maybe 8%. Again, about a twofold increase, higher background rate, higher rate when you have bevacizumab in the mix. The number of patients who had a prior event more than a year before is a very small subgroup. So I'm going to kind of limit this to the largest subgroup, which would be age over 65. If you look at that group, the benefit for bevacizumab in terms of progression-free survival, response rate, overall survival, those numbers look like the group as a whole. And because the patient's mortality and probably their biggest morbidity issue is their cancer, an increase in the cardiovascular risk doesn't change those outcomes.
Do we know anything about 75 and beyond, 80 and beyond?
Not with respect to this risk.
Any speculations?
The way I counsel patients and sort of think about this is that the risk shouldn't go down. The risk might go up a little bit. And what's the trade-off? The other issue is biological age as opposed to chronologic age. So a very fit 74, 75-year-old may be better than a patient with a lot of other comorbidities. The other thing which is not clear is what interventions may be possible to reduce that risk more. Probably, if you extrapolate from other aspects of good internal medicine care, better attention to a problem usually helps, probably a little bit better management of their blood pressure, and probably, unless there's a contraindication, using other standard cardiovascular prophylaxis such as baby aspirin and a statin, unless there's some other contraindication to using those, would probably be appropriate and may mitigate that risk a bit more. Unfortunately, the date, because the event rates are low, knowing how much the events are actually increased is hard to give an exact estimate. And I think the issues are, in aggregate, is there likely to be more benefit? What's the quantity of harm, and is there a way to mitigate it? Then I don't see any reason why we shouldn't be doing things that may help reduce the risk, absent some reason not to do those things.
Alan, you were part of our faculty panel on the Molecular Oncology 101 thing. We actually, it was cool, we had six different tumor types represented there. And George Sledge brought up the issue of, does hypertension predict response to BEV, and alluded to some new data coming out in breast that hasn't been published. You said we haven't seen that in colon. What's your take on that?
Well, I think George did say that. I've not seen the data published. There are a variety of questions of what are these epiphenomena that may predict response.
Rash.
As rash does with cetuximab. But at least in our hands, hypertension does not predict. I think part of the problem with hypertension is, when do you measure it? How do you follow patients? Did they have baseline hypertension? How aggressively are you treating it? So I at least am not convinced that that's a marker.
Lee, what do we know about that?
You know, Herb and I have been discussing this cordially over the years, whereas I have thought that vasoconstriction is a major mechanism of action of bevacizumab, and it not only occurs in the tumor, but occurs in the patient, which is why I have hypertension. And Herb always tells me, Lee, don't talk about that again. You should not treat patients till they get hypertension. But more and more of this, and I agree with Herb, I respect what he has to say, but more and more of these anecdotes are coming out. This was the ECOG 2100 data that George is discussing. Brian Reaney, who has led the field in renal cell carcinoma, as you know, had an interesting poster discussion at ASCO where he showed that if a patient who received anti-VEGF therapy for renal cell carcinoma at any time during the course of the therapy had a diastolic of 90, they appeared to do better than those who did not have a diastolic blood pressure of 90. So there are little bits and pieces of this. It hasn't been fully studied. I look forward to the ECOG 2100 study. Now, Herb always points out, you need to treat these patients. You need to be an internist as well as a medical oncologist.
Yeah, I think there are two separate issues. One is, does the development of hypertension suggest anything later? I would submit that the amount of studies which have reported their small size and the fact that they're a subset of all the studies out there mean we don't really have an answer. I think the answer could be addressed if all of the phase 3 data sets available analyze this outcome. It's hard to measure. It's treatment emergent. You get issues of definition of change in blood pressure and lots of other caveats. But this could be addressed because there are enough phase 3 studies that could look at. The second issue is, okay, even if there is an effect on blood pressure somehow correlating with outcome, what does that mean about practice? And I think the biggest caveat is, it does not imply you should not treat hypertension. Just because getting some hypertension, that may be good. That doesn't mean you should not treat it. In fact, there are lots of reasons to treat it. The second is, it doesn't mean that you should increase the dose until you get hypertension. So I think we need to be very clear on, while it's a very interesting research topic to try to understand if the trend is true and what does it mean, until there's more information, do not inappropriately ignore hypertension or try to exacerbate it without a good reason.
Let's move on to Axel's case.
My case is a now 50-year-old patient who was found to have rectal cancer eventually with liver, peritoneal, and ovarian metastasis in August 2005. She was actually found to have ovarian masses and underwent ovarectomy, and kind of in retrospect found to have, okay, this is a metastasis from rectal cancer, which was resected later. And she had biopsy-proven peritoneal metastasis, not a lot, not like this peritoneal studying, but clear peritoneal metastasis, which were not resected, and biopsy-proven liver metastasis actually scattered in almost all segments. So she started on our program with FOLFOX bevacizumab after 4 cycles, had a good response, a minor response after 4 more cycles, so kind of the response attenuated, and she developed neurotoxicity, grade 2. We stopped oxaliplatin, actually per protocol, after 8 cycles. And then she got on infusion 5 fulucavorin bevacizumab. And this was in November of 2005, and when we followed her with scans and CA went down, was normalized after the FOLFOX part, what happened on these scans is we still see the liver metastasis. Peritoneal metastasis really never showed up, but liver metastasis calcified over time. And we see remnants of these metastases, 5, 6 in her liver, and they're all completely stable. She has no symptoms from the treatment right now. She has 0 side effects of this infusion of 5-fulucavorin bevacizumab. no myelosuppression, no hand-foot syndrome, no diarrhea. She works full-time. Actually works as a nurse, not at Mayo, but she works as a nurse.
What kind of nursing does she do?
She was in intensive care initially and has now transitioned to an administrative job.
What's her family situation?
She's married, has two children, and her husband once in a while comes to see me, and because right now I only see her every 3 months, and she keeps being treated, and every time she comes back, we discuss, should we stop therapy? And so we've already kind of increased intervals because she said, I know what I have. I don't know what's happening when we stop this treatment. And we've had this discussion now for almost a year and a half every time she comes back. And last time, actually 2 weeks ago, when she came back for her visit in July, she was actually ready to say, oh, let's stop therapy. And just a couple of days before, Tony Snow had died. She was to say, no, I really don't want to get off therapy. And so why don't we spread it out to 4 weeks? And I said, you know, I really don't know whether what we're doing is right or wrong. I have no idea. Because when you stop a patient that has no side effects, apparently completely stable disease, we see calcified tumor remnants without any changes in her lab values. And she works full time.
How old are her kids?
12 and 14. So what do you do? And I don't know whether this patient's cured. Can this patient ever be cured? Should we stop treatment? What if it comes back? When do we declare patients to be cured? Can we declare patients to be cured when we still see some liver metastases which are calcified?
Neil? I got a question for Axel. In your heart, what do you really think the downside of giving this poor woman a treatment holiday would be? Yeah, she's having no side effects. She's fully active, but she's got to deal with you every 2 or 3 months. She's got to have her blood drawn.
That's a bad one.
I mean, she's carrying a pump around. It's not like she's having no, quote, toxicity related to this treatment. If you think she's curable, then continuing her beyond 3 years on therapy, it's hard for me to believe that that has any impact on her
yes.
cure. So what are you doing here?
Yes, and I really, every time she comes in, I try to persuade her to, let's say, you know, I would like to stop. She is the one who demands, and actually, she was as ready as it could be 2 weeks ago, and then she said, no, I really like to continue. Very hard for me to, do we have any data that it's good or not good to stop therapy? I really don't know.
You know, a bunch of you have been involved with our patient study project that we're now like in the fourth or fifth year. And we had a poster at both ASCO GI and ASCO that you all, a lot of you participated in asking that horrible question, what would you do if it were you, doc? And we did this about adjuvant therapy. She ever asked that to you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And point
is, you say when she asked you that?
I normally tell people when they ask me directly, and I would probably keep on bevacizumab.
And you told her that?
You look for. Yes, I did. That was actually what she asked me a year and a half ago when we first started talking about stopping therapy.
Charlie?
Has she asked you to do Bev alone?
No, she has not.
What do you think about that idea, Charlie?
You know, admittedly, in similar circumstances, to help patients sort of ease into the idea of withdrawing therapy, I've done it.
What do you all think about the whole issue of VEGF rebound? That actually, is, you mentioned the E2100 study in breast that showed progression-free but not overall survival, and Kathy Miller speculated maybe this is VEGF rebound.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the issues that's kind of comes into play when I look at this case. 2 points. In Herb's study, 50% of patients went on to go to keep bevacizumab beyond progression in the IFL arm, which could have led to this huge impact on overall survival, which we saw, which we've never really talked about. So 50% of patients in Herb's study had bevacizumab beyond progression. In the breast cancer trial, the interesting phenomenon for me is not that, okay, there's progression-free survival and there's overall survival.
There is an overall
survival. There's no overall survival benefit, but there's progression-free survival. Why do patients who get off bevacizumab live 6 months shorter than patients who did not have bevacizumab in first-line therapy?
In which study?
In the breast cancer study. Patients who got off Bev had a 6 month shorter overall survival than patients who never got on bevacizumab at the time of progression.
Herb?
I think for people taking care of patients, there are a couple sort of key points. One is clinical trial data, as Charlie Fuchs has reminded me many times, is if you take a patient who fit the eligibility criteria, got the treatment on average, you're going to get the results reported in the manuscript. It doesn't deal with the patients who are the outliers. It doesn't do with the subset with best biology. I think a lot can be explained for this bevacizumab past progression. It may be a real effect. It may also be completely a patient selection. and who have more favorable biology, which is the old rule, if you do better, you do better. And it really could also be both. And it may be those people with the best biology are those most likely to benefit from treatment.
What do you think his case is?
I actually suspect that all treatment tends to work better in better biology. I don't see why bevacizumab, which particularly seems to have a...
But I mean biology or response to therapy?
Yeah, I'm using biology as a black box term for everything about the tumor, which is prognostic, more likely to respond to any treatment, more likely to respond to some treatment. With that, I think when people are wrestling with the decision about what to do for the patient, there are a couple easy principles. How are they tolerating it? Because everything's risk-benefit. If they're tolerating this extremely well and the parking is very accessible, then the inconvenience aspect.
Very short.
And then the other is, how are they? What's the benefit? We don't need to use RECIST criteria on every patient in clinical practice. There's nothing sacred about 20% progression. It does not account for ambiguous responses, does not account for rate of progression. And there's clearly something different about someone who progresses in 2 months versus 2 years. The biggest caveat I would make in trying to make the individualized decision for the patient about long-term therapy is you need to be particularly attentive to the potential risks which may accumulate over time. And I would be particularly attentive that if you're going to pursue that strategy with all of its, you know, pros and cons which have been discussed, I would be particularly attentive for cumulative toxicities like proteinuria, cardiovascular risk, and I would check things like thyroid, obviously the urine protein.
Thyroid?
Thyroid abnormalities have been reported in a small percentage of patients across all VEGF inhibitor studies.
I've heard about that with the TKIs, but I'm not sure I heard about it before the antibodies. Yeah.
The other would be sort of being sure you've got an echocardiogram at some sort of frequency to pick up on subclinical cardiomyopathy.
You doing all that stuff? Does she have hypertension, proteinuria?
She has hypertension. I mean, she's on
Lisinopril,
5 milligrams, yeah, which actually was pre-existing, so we really didn't have to change the dose. She has no proteinuria.
Rich?
I wanted to make 2 points. One is some good news about RECIST. Many of us have resisted RECIST for years because it's so onerous, and the NCI is reevaluating that, and data has been presented that essentially shows that measuring one lesion is as good as measuring 10 lesions, and that there's no real need to confirm response. And I think that that's part of what we've been learning from waterfall plots. You know, we believe that people benefit from treatments if their tumor biology changes, and it's somewhat artificial to say it only is considered a response if the tumor benefit is thus and so. So it's likely that in clinical trials, at least, it's going to get easier to evaluate patients for response endpoints, fewer lesions to measure, and no need to confirm.
Any discussion about dynamic imaging or other endpoints?
I don't think that's really widely disseminated at this point, but I think that's likely to be here in 10 years. The other point I'd like to make is that we had done a study back in the dark ages when only there was 5-FU and leucovorin, looking at patients who'd been enrolled on clinical trials through NCCTG, and we'd found a 5-year disease-free survival rate of 1% at that time. And we have a paper in press at JCO now looking at the data from the FOLFOX arm of 9741 that shows a 10% 5-year survival. And many of those patients never received surgery and are disease-free. So I think that gets to the point that we are probably going to see more patients who are long-term survivors of advanced colon cancer. And that was in the era before the biologics, whether the biologics will be synergistic in terms of increasing the rate of long-term survivals is yet to be determined.
Dan?
I would love to have a level one clinical trial that tested what the ideal treatment holiday is, whether it's a week at the Red Roof Inn or a month at the Four Seasons. It's not clear to me. But I think what we've been discussing is that it's a dynamic process, is that you identify the winners as you continue to treat them, and then you begin to make decisions, which is why it's so hard to do a clinical trial. My gut tells me if someone comes with a lot of visceral disease and is symptomatic, that's not a patient you should start with low-intensity therapy. And probably if they take a vacation, it will definitely be a weekend at the Red Roof Inn. They're not going to be off treatment for a long time.
Axel?
I mean, in some ways, what we're doing right now in this case is already giving some treatment holidays. I mean, we're talking about every four-week treatment. I don't know that 5-FU leucovorin administered over 2 days will really cover 4 weeks of potential tumor growth. So in some ways, we're doing exactly what you're saying. We get to know these patients. We're selecting those patients who have this good biology. And the treatment effect could have been exactly the same with just 5-FU leucovorin in this patient or just whatever, capecitabine, you name it. I do believe that tumor biology beats our treatment effect here. So in some ways, we're getting there. And it's more or less making this patient comfortable and addressing her fears to stop therapy. And at some point, when every 4 weeks treatment is fine, we'll probably take her off therapy.
Jordan?
Axel, aren't you just doing homeopathic 5-FU at this point? I mean, you know, the fact is that those of us south of the Mason-Dixon line actually do give treatment holidays, I guess, a lot more than it sounds like you do in the frozen tundras, because we actually do a lot of treatment breaks. And the guy who I presented, is not uncommon for me to have 4-6 month treatment breaks. My longest one is one on Mace's FOLFOX second line trial, who's still on treatment break. But the bottom line is that there has to come a time when one really has to seriously look at treatment breaks. You're really battering these patients with 5 years straight of chemotherapy and homeopathic 5-FU. I don't know that you're doing anything more than psychotherapy. And Dave Johnson always says chemotherapy is not good psychotherapy.
Okay, first of all, I mean, we're talking about very individual patients. When you see this patient, that's where all these theoretic discussions really come into play. But in the end, this is a very, very personal decision whether or not to give her a treatment or not. The second point is, it's probably my hesitation to just use bevacizumab by itself. Yeah, I don't like bevacizumab, a single agent. That's why I'm keeping this 5-FU around.
I want to get your final comments, too, about the issue of, in general, continuation of Bevo and progression. This was a big topic last year after your presentation at ASCO, and I was really surprised at your reaction in terms of how you changed the way you looked at things based on that data. And we saw the exact same thing last summer when we did our patterns of care study. Alan?
Well, I had two comments. I can address that. But the other comment is, I think many of us, you can look at the biology years later, you realize was favorable. I would have said this patient had what could have been a favorable prognosis once they start calcifying their mets. That's typically a mucinous tumor. And while prognostically, when they present, they're likelier to be metastatic. But in my experience, those are the patients who have long-term survival is once they calcify their mets. Often they'll present with part of their mets being calcified.
Is it easier to calcify their mets?
I don't know.
Get them to respond?
You know, I don't quite understand the mechanism, but at least my experience is that the patient who has a partially calcified metastatic burden is the patient who you may get a surprisingly long-term survival.
Are you saying calcification before treatment?
Well,
or after
even
treatment?
Patients who present with multiple mets and some of them are calcified, in my experience, those are patients who really can do extraordinarily well.
You know what it may be, Alan, is that mucinous tumors tend to be MSI positive.
Right. Yeah,
but and so it may
retest it that. It
and she's not?
But,
no.
But in any case, I think, so I will look at a patient, and I'm likelier to give a patient a holiday earlier on if they're calcifying their mets than if their mets disappear. And I think that I may be wrong on some occasions, but that's my gestalt, is that that's a different patient.
Can we pool all our experiences? I mean, we could, I agree with your calcification, good prognostic factor idea. Should we pool all this from different trials? I mean, I would like to have some predictor of whether we can give holidays or not. Calcification is easy to see.
Dan?
Certainly one of the most interesting tests to get in these people are bone scans, because I've seen a number of patients whose liver looks like clouds from the literally so much calcification in their liver, and they do have a good outcome. And I think it's just that they've lived with their tumor for so long, they have necrosis, both autonecrosis,
right,
maybe immunologic, maybe it is the host tumor effect, or maybe it's what we're actually doing to them.
Axel, what have you seen in the last year in terms of your response to the data that you presented last year from the BRIGHT registry? Again, interesting, thinking about the oncologist, you know, breast and lung and a lot of other tumors are also wrestling with this question, a continuation of Bev. The oncologist, they have a lot more data and experience in colon, and they're actually bringing that over to the other tumors. But what about the more common situation, not this lady, but a patient who's had a good response to chemo-Bev and then eventually progresses on the Bev in terms of continuation? What are you doing? What do you think people in practice are doing?
It really depends on whether I think, my personal approach is whether I think patients had a benefit from bevacizumab first-line therapy, which is, of course, no one really knows whether the benefit was from chemotherapy or bevacizumab. When I don't see, let's say, a rapid growth, when I see the small smoldering growth, which eventually crosses the line where you say, okay, we need to change therapy, I tend to keep bevacizumab around. In patients who have dramatic progression, I don't keep bevacizumab around outside of a clinical trial. In the community setting, we have to keep in mind, even before these data were presented, about 50% of oncologists already use bevacizumab beyond progression, because this is probably also because of its relatively good toxicity profile. I mean, there's really not a lot of perceived side effects.
And I think a lot of it is the trastuzumab analogy, incidentally.
Yeah, and
they got used to
very,
doing it.
Very
there.
Similar to trastuzumab. There are some emerging data on trastuzumab,
yeah,
actually.
Very
interesting data that it makes sense to use trastuzumab beyond progression. And we have to keep in mind that resistance to a therapeutic approach can come at different times. I do believe that there are patients who, there are tumors who eventually become resistant to any anti-VEGF therapy, but it might not be at the same time when they become resistant to the chemotherapy effect. I think this evolving way of thinking that we might have to be a little bit more careful how we address the biologic agents, in particular when we're not directly targeting the tumor. But eventually, this question has to be addressed in a clinical trial, in a randomized setting. And while we are having some problems getting this trial up and running and really kind of accruing patients here in the United States, a European endeavor is underway which will probably solve this issue and address this issue in a...
You're talking about the IBET study?
No, it's not the IBET study. It's actually...
I'm talking about your study here.
Our study here is the IBET study, the SWOG-led 0600 study. But the Europeans now have adopted this idea and have a very pragmatic approach and will probably solve this question whether bevacizumab should be used beyond progression before we can.
Lee, I guess an example we don't think about this idea continuing a biologic has actually been utilized for a long time without very much data is in prostate cancer, where they keep these men LHRH seemingly indefinitely. What do you think about that strategy in terms of biologics in general and this situation specifically?
So I think we can learn a lot about the biology that we observe in our patients. For example, in the clinical trials with anti-VEGF therapy, we know that VEGF levels go up. The body needs VEGF, so the body is trying to make up for the lack of VEGF signaling. But we also have to pay attention to the fact that other VEGF family ligands go up, such as placenta growth factor, which also binds to VEGF receptor 1. And basic FGF appears to be a resistance factor to anti-VEGF therapy. So I want to throw a new idea out there, as rather than continue bevacizumab after patients have progressed on a regimen containing bevacizumab, because we don't know what they're resistant to, that this is not, of course, FDA approved, but perhaps the basis for a clinical trial is to tweak the anti-VEGF therapy, that you could possibly use a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which inhibits VEGFR1, R2, R3, possibly other angiogenic receptors such as the basic FGF receptors, etc. So rather than BEV beyond progression, perhaps it's VEGF inhibition beyond progression, which is a question where we may be able to tweak the therapy and then gain additional benefit by inhibiting additional angiogenic receptors.
Is there any TKI out there right now where you'd actually like to see a study now, or do we need more data?
I think we need more data because there are no TKIs that are approved at the present time in
colon cancer.
How
about a research setting?
Research setting, there are 30 TKIs
in clinical trials. How about 2171?
2171 is relatively specific for the VEGF receptors. There are others. I think Sutent's a good drug because it was used in the right indications, and also it has a profile where it hits multiple tyrosine kinase receptors and other kinases within a cell. I would frankly go to a broad-spectrum kinase inhibitor rather than a narrow-spectrum kinase inhibitor.
Dan?
Just briefly, I think there's obviously a lot of interest in this question, and I think for the people who are going to listen to this in an upcoming issue of the JCO will be a part of the BRIGHT trial about bevacizumab beyond progression by one of our participants, Dr. Grothy, an editorial by two other people, Lee Ellis and myself, on the topic, and also a very important editorial by Mark Levine on what you can and cannot learn from registry trials to give the pros and the cons, and especially the pitfalls of registry trials.
So give us the bottom line. The paper, any surprises that we haven't heard before?
No, it gives a little bit more details about how the analysis was conducted, and hopefully adds credibility to the idea. Actually, one of the reviewer's comments, which was quite interesting, was what appeared to be just a fluke of data, after really reading the manuscript, has convinced me that this is the right way to go.
And two editorials, what's their bottom line?
Well, Lee can talk about our editorial, but the bottom line on Mark Levine's editorial, which we put there because there'll be another registry trial from Wilke in Europe called the MABEL trial, is just simply because so many registry trials now exist, and people have to know what to expect from them because they're used, I think, too much for marketing purposes and too little for science. And
although,
so
in fairness, they're usually obligated to do that by the regulatory agencies. So Genentech didn't do Bright or Beat just as a publicity or marketing ploy. Some of this is mandated for post-marketing data.
It was interesting in this biomarker thing in breast cancer. We had Richard Simon from the NCI, and we're talking about how do you do studies of predictive markers? What's the right way? What's the wrong way? Do you think, Dan, that we'll see that with registries? What's the right way and wrong way to do a registry study?
I think we'll have to learn how to do them, because Alan make a very good point, is that, yes, they were not done primarily as marketing. I'm not sure the companies actually wanted to spend as much money as they did to do it. It is somewhat clinical comfort food, as Herb pointed out. There was no obvious bad news, but still there are selection biases of who enters a registry trials that you'll never will learn.
I mean, I found it very comforting. Granted, maybe there's some differences, but there weren't like huge things out there.
I think, you know, the biggest comfort for me is that it looks like people in practice are practicing good medicine. That is, the people that they're treating look like the people that are in the clinical trials. It's not wildly different. And the outcomes in terms of overall survival and PFS mirror clinical trials. So our trials in practice are in equilibrium.
I mean, our patterns of care studies consistently show that at least docs, what they say they do is very similar to what you say you do. Final comment from Lee in terms of your editorial. What's the theme that's going to come out there?
The data is very intriguing, and it's a large number of patients. We clearly point out the fact that there could perhaps be a selection bias, or there is a selection bias. The question is, even with the selection bias, the data is very intriguing. And we need to use this as a hypothesis-generating study rather than as a definitive study, and it needs to be tested in a clinical trial, which Axel had already started but is put on hold because of all the KRAS issues.
But you got to have a sentence in there about what to do outside of trials.
Treating patients with metastatic disease is an art. And I think we have at MD Anderson 28 different GI medical oncologists and 28 different ways of treating patients in the same setting.
I want to shift over to a discussion of new agents coming down the pike. We were talking before about VEGF TKIs and 2171 or cediranib. Alan, what did you think about the paper that was presented by David Cunningham at ASCO looking at this agent in a phase 2 randomized study at two dose levels with FOLFOX compared to FOLFOX Bev as second line therapy, and also the phase 3 randomized Horizon studies looking at this in the first line setting?
Cediranib is AZD2171 and already has a name, Recentin, so it's not a drug yet, but they've already named it. And this is an oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor that targets VEGFs R1, 2, and 3. So this is an oral VEGF inhibitor. The study that David presented was Horizon 1, which is a phase 2 double-blind study of FOLFOX cediranib at two different doses versus FOLFOX Bev in patients who'd failed irinotecan and hadn't seen Bev up front. So this is sort of a population we wouldn't see very much elsewhere in the world. This was largely done in Europe. And the data they presented in Horizon 1 was on 215 patients. Horizons 1, 2, and 3 studies with cediranib in colon cancer. And the pertinent issue for all of us is that this drug is in phase 3 clinical trial in first-line patients with FOLFOX Bev at 5 versus FOLFOX with either the drug at 20 or 30 milligrams. It's accrued a goodly number of patients towards the ultimate accrual goal of 1,400 or 1,500 patients. The data that is presented in the abstract and in the paper at ASCO is the toxicity profile, which, of course, this is a drug that affects VEGF, and the standard class effects are seen. But the one thing that they do show in the poster is a surprisingly high percentage of patients with asthenia who come off treatment because of asthenia. And they also report elevated TSH in a high percentage of patients. But I think my take-home message is that it would be great to have an oral tyrosine kinase inhibitor targeting that pathway. This is in pivotal trials, but looks like it has what may be a troublesome toxicity profile, and I'm not sure it's equivalent to Bev, which is what it would need to be.
You know, this issue of asthenia and fatigue with biologics is something we're hearing in all different kinds of tumors. I'm not sure I can quite figure out what's going on. Are there cytokines involved? Dan, what's your take on that?
I can only comment on the fact that we've been getting a lot of letters and some reports about some TKIs, particularly sunitinib, which might be used for long periods of time in a number of tumors, including GIST patients who are refractory to imatinib, where hypothyroidism is becoming more and more common, as with interferon, which causes it in the long term. So much of the asthenia, fatigue, and vague symptoms that people present with on these drugs may be in part be due to clinical hypothyroidism, although elevated TSH is the more common.
Right. In these Horizon studies, the best I understand, the asthenia did not correlate with hypothyroidism. Those were not related.
And that's what generally we've been hearing. What about the issue of drug development with biologics? I was struck by your comment, I think it was last year, about the issue of how sorafenib rolled out in HCC. The initial data with the phase 1-2 studies you weren't that impressed with, and then this phase 3 study came out that was positive, and the whole question of how do you study biologics? How do you apply that to this situation?
Right. So the dilemma, of course, is when you have a drug that may not meet the standard response criteria that give you go-no-go decisions, where do you test it? And so the sort of evolution is to test it with chemotherapy. And in a way, our success makes it much tougher to develop new drugs because you're threading the eye of a needle trying to figure out where you can test it and what's a good enough result. The development strategy was perfectly reasonable with this drug, and that is add it to chemotherapy in second line and look for a differential. The fascinating thing to me is I look at the second line data and I don't see that there's a go component to that, but there's different threshold for making that decision. I think it's an immensely difficult question. And other than testing all of these agents in fourth line, it's going to be very difficult. Now, in a perverse way, the mutant versus wild type KRAS dichotomy gives us an opportunity to move other drugs earlier into the treatment paradigm.
So, for example, Jordan's patient.
Correct.
In terms of what
now,
study.
And, you know, so do you look at different pathways, but it's still the same complexity of do you expect these biologics to have single agent activity? If you look at the sorafenib data, it doesn't induce any tumor shrinkage in HCC. So the issue was, is there a prolongation of progression-free survival? Very hard endpoint, very hard to know what's good enough to justify moving forward. I think it's a real challenge.
Jordan?
I'm risking, I can't remember if this has been shown publicly or not, but if I remember correctly, sorafenib actually shows some intriguing waterfall plots where, although you look at the waterfall plot of the sorafenib versus the placebo and there is a difference, that's where a waterfall plot can be helpful, although, you know, could also be deceptive for all I know.
That was in renal cell. In HCC, they're really, I've not seen a waterfall.
Rich?
So does anybody else worry about the TKIs? Because rather than innocent bystander effects of chemotherapy on rapidly dividing cells where we affect the mucosa, the hair-producing cells, and the bone marrow, we're actually interfering with the mechanisms that are fundamental to cellular survival, not just in rapidly turning over cells, but in cells that are fixed, like liver and muscle. And that may be why, instead of the magic bullet, we're finding that we have drugs that have limiting toxicities that are sort of undefinable and global, like asthenia or fatigue, which are probably traceable back to some specific cellular process that we just don't understand. So, Lee, I'm going to turn to you again as the guy in the lab to see what you think about that.
We assume that drugs are interchangeable if they're all hitting the same target, and I think we've learned over the past few years that the obvious is not going to be obvious. These drugs are not interchangeable. Each TKI that targets the VEGF pathway has off-target effects, and although the companies may advertise the major targets, there are hundreds of kinases, some many of which we know, many of which we know nothing about and haven't been discovered yet. So these off-target effects, I think, are a problem. And some VEGF receptor TKIs, patients will have a cough. Some will have fatigue. Some will have a change in the hair color. Some will have bone marrow suppression, thyroid suppression. So this is an important system in homeostasis. So one question is, are these drugs too effective? Are they eliciting too much of a compensatory response? And when we've combined the antibody with a tyrosine kinase inhibitor, we've seen some trials which have been stopped for various reasons. On the other hand, in development, there are antibodies to PLGF, placental growth factor, by Peter Carmeliet from Belgium, where I call that bevacizumab light, where you do inhibit perhaps angiogenesis, perhaps, it hasn't been proven in the clinic yet, but you don't have that compensatory response. So I think it's possible to have drugs which may be too potent at nanomolar concentrations, and we always seek for more is better, and I'm still a believer of that in biologic systems, but maybe the compensatory response has a detrimental effect, and perhaps that's one of the things that's happening in the PACE trial and the Cairo-2 trial.
Could you elaborate a little bit more about the issue of combining TKIs with antibodies, what was seen with renal cell, and whether you think in the long run this is a strategy that's going to be useful?
Herb and I were talking about this, so I may let Herb talk about it just a bit more, but there have been a number of trials where the combination of sorafenib and bevacizumab or the combination of Sutent and bevacizumab have been conducted, mostly phase 1 and phase 2 trials. And for the most part, they have been able to accrue through the trials and meet their accrual goals. However, in about 50% of those trials, they had to stop the trial early due to toxicity. Some was fatigue, some was a very refractory patient population where they frankly didn't do well. That was the initial trial from the NCI. And then there's some more recent data that came out, and Herb and I were talking about, and maybe Herb would like to comment on that.
Herb?
Yeah, I think the easiest answer is combining drugs within the same axis are not ready for prime time in general clinical use. There is some logic in the lab. There is some logic on the wall chart. The data suggests that at least in some settings and modest-sized trials, there's enough toxicity to be of significant concern. The trial of bevacizumab plus sorafenib in ovarian cancer had an unacceptably high perforation rate. A recent trial with sunitinib and bevacizumab had an unacceptably high rate of microangiopathic hemolytic anemia. And that safety letter probably has been mailed to most oncologists, you know, in the last week. There may be different organs which are at higher risk. The kidney cancer population may be at particularly special risk because having had a nephrectomy, the one remaining kidney may have hemodynamics and other issues which are a little bit different. But with all of those disclaimers, there are some hints that there may be toxicities which are unacceptable, at least in some populations. So until there's clearly efficacy and efficacy versus toxicity information to make a decision about risk-benefit, the easy answer is it's an intriguing concept which has enough complexity that it shouldn't be done outside of a clinical trial.
Where do you think things are heading in general with VEGF, TKIs, and colorectal cancer?
I'm not sure exactly. I think there have been multiple tyrosine kinase inhibitors that target VEGF have announced or they're conducting large phase 2 or phase 3 trials in colon cancer, cedarinib, sunitinib. I would be surprised if there were not others. And we'll see how the data sort out. I think there's enough to suggest that they may be active. There's data to suggest they may be no better than bevacizumab, and there's data to suggest they may not be as good, which is exactly why there need to be well-conducted studies to answer the question.
What about the issue of dosing with TKIs? This came up with your discussion. What was the name of that drug again?
PTK-787.
What about 2171? How did they approach it in terms of the pharmacodynamics?
I'd have to look at the half-life of 2171. I don't recall that, but I think it's daily
hours.
Dosing.
It's long.
20
daily
hours.
Dosing.
So as opposed to the PTK, which has a half-life of 3 to 6 hours, you wouldn't get the rebound effect of VEGF without inhibiting the receptor. You have a nice half-life of 20 hours, and sorafenib is anywhere from 8 to 12 hours, but it's dosed twice a day. So I think if you're going to have an effective anti-VEGF agent, you have to completely block the axis over a 24-hour period and not allow leakiness of the system in order to where you get, you know, stimulation again. As far as the pharmacokinetics, there were reports of PTK having an effect, I believe, on irinotecan metabolism. And I don't know if the other tyrosine kinase inhibitors will also affect other chemotherapeutic agents in the regimen.
Anything new in terms of speculating mechanism of action in terms of BEG? Finally, I interviewed Rakesh Jain a couple weeks ago. That was awesome.
We just published a review in Nature Reviews Cancer a week ago, Dan Hicklin and myself, on mechanisms of action of anti-VEGF therapy. So we covered about 6 or 7 different mechanisms of action of anti-VEGF therapy, which includes inhibiting new blood vessel growth, destruction of existing blood vessels, vasoconstriction, normalization, offsetting the effects of chemotherapy-induced induction of VEGF and VEGF family members, and the immune system. And I think the mechanism of action of anti-VEGF therapy in renal cell carcinoma, where you have significant single-agent activity, is completely different than the mechanism of action in lung or colon cancer or hepatocellular carcinoma.
How about ovary?
We can only speculate.
And they have a fairly substantial single-agent response rate.
True. And I think we have to look at that list of six or seven mechanisms of action that we listed, and there's probably more that we haven't discovered yet, and figure out in each disease type which one of those mechanisms of action would be appropriate. And I would not say it's 100% of any single mechanism of action responsible for the efficacy in any single tumor type with any single drug. I think there are going to be multiple mechanisms of action that play a role. I think the critical question is not necessarily the mechanism of action, but the mechanism of resistance. And that's something which is being investigated by Napoleon Ferrara, who had a number of cells that myeloid cells released from the bone marrow can mediate resistance to anti-VEGF therapy.
How does that work?
That works by CD11 B-positive GR1 positive cells being released by the bone marrow, which infiltrate a tumor, which will release other angiogenic factors. One newly described angiogenic factor is BV8. Which was initially discovered in frogs, which seems to mediate VEGF resistance. Now, this is very much in preclinical studies, but he has a Nature paper and a Nature Medicine paper in this area, which are two very high-impact papers, and he continues to elucidate mechanisms of resistance. Doug Hanahan and Gabby Burgers just published a review in Nature Cancer Reviews in the same edition that we just published our paper in, looking at mechanisms of resistance. So the more we know about the resistance, the more we may learn about selecting appropriate patients for therapy and how to treat them in subsequent lines of therapy, whether to continue with bevacizumab, continue with another VEGF receptor tyrosine kinase inhibitor, or go to a completely different attack on the vasculature. And those are things that are all, of course, hypothetical.
Dan, let's hear about your case and the issue of hepatic resection for cure. You told me about this young man who developed hepatic recurrence a couple of years after primary colon cancer surgery.
A 38-year-old man referred to me after receiving 12 cycles of FOLFOX Bev for 4 liver lesions, right lobe. In review of the original CT scans, they appeared to have been resectable at the time of presentation, but he got unintentional neoadjuvant therapy because they never considered resection at all. So now 3 are no longer visible by CT, and the PET is now completely negative. So what do you do with someone like this? I don't think there is a right answer. As Rich was saying, there's certainly one of the most important things to elicit are what are the wrong answers in these particular situations. I certainly wouldn't want to give him more chemotherapy at this time of that type to avoid further hepatotoxicity because he almost certainly has some. Certainly, we obtained a surgical opinion about resecting the areas where the original lesions were located. And I think a discussion point we should have is, when do you stop treating? Are you going for a CR where the surgeon then has to guess where to operate? Or should you stop at a point where they're still visible? And the other flip side of that is what I mentioned earlier, which is that some clinical CRs by PET and CT still have viable tumor, and we have pretty good data on that. And conversely, some tumors that are still visible by CT scan are pathologically negative. And there's going to be an editorial on that as well in an upcoming issue of the journal about the complexities of this, sort of obtaining what Rich is talking about at a pathologic level rather than a biologic level.
So let me start with Alan and ask you, A, how in general would you be approaching this patient up front if you thought that these lesions were resectable in terms of systemic therapy or surgery first? Second of all, what would you do in this situation right now if you're seeing the patient? And third, what kind of trial would you like to see done on these kinds of people?
Right. So if the 4 lesions, some of it would depend on the interval from the primary.
2 years.
So 2 years, if it was an easy hepatic resection, I might do it, although my instinct would almost certainly be to give chemotherapy. But what I would do is 2 months of chemo, 4 cycles of either FOLFOX, BEV, depending on what their adjuvant was, I would give 4 cycles of therapy, reassess, and if the patient isn't progressing and doesn't have other sites of disease, then I would take them to surgery.
So are you generally using systemic therapy in resectable patients?
Except in the, you know, if it's a solitary met, I think it's greatly variable on the protoplasm of the patient, where the met is. But to me, the big distinction is the time period since the primary.
And your usual perioperative therapy is FOLFOX-BEV?
No, actually, so in a patient who I was doing sort of a bioassay for, just to see if they're going to blossom disease everywhere else, I often don't use Bev. So I might use full Fox or full Fury alone four cycles. If it's resectable to begin with, I don't need a robust response. I don't want the patient to have a stroke or an MI.
So they have a response, they get resected, what do you use post-op?
Well, then if they had response from the therapy I use first, I use it on the back end.
No Bev?
I might add Bev on the back end. But again, I think this is a good example. Four lesions. The problem is the patient probably already has some hepatic damage, may make it a difficult resection. In terms of the study that needs to be done, again, I think it's too hard to do, but what Nordlinger did wasn't neoadjuvant study, it was chemo or no chemo. And I think a neoadjuvant study versus no neoadjuvant would be really important. But again, I just think it's incredibly difficult to see that getting done.
Axel?
So I actually...
What would you do with this patient right now?
Right now, I mean, along the lines of what Dan said here, I mean, kind of radiologic CR is hardly ever a path CR. And so one option would be to perform a right hepatectomy, and which is at least what our liver surgeons tell me is very easy to do. This patient has already had time to declare other metastases, and it didn't show up PET negative. So right hepatectomy and looking through the liver would be one option. You could also just follow, wait, and see what happens, and perform surgery when needed. I think this case highlights don't treat to best response, treat to resectability. But this patient actually had resectable metastasis to begin with. So I would have probably discussed with a patient, if the patient wants to be on the safe side, right hepatectomy.
In what situations would you use pre-op biologic or pre-op Bev when you're trying to create resectability?
So I don't think that's often the case. But to me, neoadjuvant chemotherapy is a bioassay for who has bad disease and who doesn't. But if you've got a big lesion that's central and you need some tumor shrinkage, you need a robust response, that to me is when I use a biologic. Or if in a KRAS wild-type patient where there aren't surgical and other risks of Bev, I might favor using cetuximab up front in that patient. Part of decision-making is, and how I look at things, are my experience. I had a patient who was in the community, had a perfectly resectable liver met, got FOLFOX Bev, and had a massive stroke. And this patient now is paralyzed and has resectable disease. And
how old is the patient?
This was a 50-year-old. And so I remember that for a long time in terms of what was the value of giving Bev in that patient. Now, I don't know that's why the patient had the stroke, but that to me, so I think that the lesson I took from that is, why are you using Bev? It needn't be the default position.
Lee?
So Axel and I are very good friends, but sometimes friends disagree.
Okay.
Axel had mentioned that in this patient, he would observe the patient for a period of time. I feel like this is a presidential debate. He would observe the patient for a period of time and see what would happen.
It's my option. I said my preferred option would be right hepatectomy.
So I would not list that as one of the options. I think it is fair to say you can possibly continue therapy. It is fair to say that you would plan on surgery 8 weeks later, or you could give several courses of chemotherapy in between and make sure the Bev gets out of the system. And we can talk about wound healing and bevacizumab afterwards. But one option I would not give is simply to follow the patient and wait to see when the tumor starts to grow. And as a liver surgeon, I would feel very bad about a patient who was resectable who became unresectable. I think chemo holidays are very important. It's something that I advocate in my patients with my medical oncology colleagues. But in regards to a patient who is resectable, you don't want to miss that window of opportunity.
Can you comment a little bit on what we know about the impact of particularly chemotherapeutic agents and duration of treatment on the liver?
So this was mentioned by Alan, and we have several agents that we can give patients in the neoadjuvant setting if we're going to do that. 5-FU can cause hepatic steatosis. It's not a major, major player. Irinotecan can lead to steatohepatitis, which is a major determinant of postoperative liver failure, wound healing complications, etc. Oxaliplatin can cause sinusoidal dilatation, which makes the liver look blue, but that's the only side effect. There really are not any liver-related toxicities to oxaliplatin.
So it's not a functional issue.
It's not a functional issue. I think the other thing we have to consider, and which are not reported on many of our case reports, are the patient themselves, the body habitus of the patient. Patients who have a high body mass index are at a much greater risk for postoperative complications, hepatic steatosis, sensitivity to hepatic steatosis from chemotherapy than those patients who are in better shape. So I think this is why this is difficult to study in a clinical trial. You have not only the disease, but you also have the host harboring the disease, which plays a big role in determining if somebody should go to surgery.
And I think what I've heard a lot in terms of the interest in a trial that what you described is to better define what really is going on in terms of the impact on the liver. Rich?
It's interesting to me that we contemplate giving resectable patients with liver metastases pre-op chemotherapy. But if we were to see a patient with a primary tumor that then had a CAT scan and had three large lymph nodes in the peritumoral area, so we knew they were stage three, we don't talk about giving that same patient preoperative chemotherapy. We take them to the OR and we take the disease out, and then we follow the principle that we're treating minimal residual disease for cure. And I sort of like that principle in liver resections, too. So if you can get it out, I'd rather have it out, and then I'd like to mop up with chemotherapy when the gross disease is gone. But I feel like I'm swimming against the tide when I bring that up, because I think that many oncologists like the chemo assay before the resection, and I'd be interested to hear what other people think.
And I want to poll the group, but let me just ask you, do you feel strongly enough that if a second opinion and the first opinion is pre-op chemo for you to say, I don't think that's a good idea, or just that's not what I would
do? I would say that's a matter of philosophy, but my philosophy is I would go the other way.
Neil?
Yeah, I'll be your swimming partner, Rich, on this one. When I'm faced with a patient with metastatic colon cancer to liver, I'm asking myself the same question everybody asks themselves: does this person need chemotherapy? Well, first, is this person curable ever? And then number two, if the answer is yes, then it's does this person need chemotherapy now? And that's where there's this gray area of what does it mean to need chemotherapy? And to some extent, it relates to both the technical aspects of surgery, how much liver you're going to leave behind, and that's black and white once you see a surgeon. At least for the medical oncologist, it's black and white. The surgeon tells you they could either get it out or not. But the one that's more difficult is the one where it's technically feasible to get it out, but the prognostic indicators, short disease-free interval, lots of mets, you know, big size, all the things that go into these prognostic models suggest that this is a person who is at high risk of failing shortly after having the hepatic resection. And that's where it's most difficult.
What about the issue of converting to resectability?
Great. Well, that's the category of people who you answer the question, is this person ever curable?
Okay.
Maybe
so
yes. Then do they need?
Okay. So in that situation, what systemic therapy do you generally utilize?
I generally utilize a FOLFOX with bevacizumab regimen initially, but in the marathoner who really needs a dramatic response to get to surgery, but it might be possible, have I considered a FOLFOXIRI type regimen in that setting? Yes.
With Bev?
Yeah.
Dan? Just to stay with the fish here in terms of the resected patients, you've already heard Nick Petrelli's comments on this at ASCO last year, and the editorial hasn't changed, which is that he and I favor post-operative therapy and just operating first if someone's resectable. And I'd like to hear from Lee the comment that some people use to say, well, if people progress on treatment, then they shouldn't be resected. You know, in the Norlinger study, that happened only very rarely. Most people still went on to surgery. Now, they still may do worse, but as in regard to Rich's comment, if you did have a patient with a big T4 tumor and nodes on MRI scan, you would still do their operation. You would not pretest them with chemotherapy before you resected them, no matter how bad their prognosis was.
I agree with all of that, and I sometimes swim upstream too. I mean, my point is it's not a one-size-fits-all. So to me, a patient who is resectable today but with a bit of progression is not going to be resectable, that's a patient I would take immediately to surgery, all of these other things independent. So again, I think it's hard to draw up an algorithm that deals with every patient.
I want to hear from Herb and Charlie what your usual approach is to the resectable patient in terms of whether they go to surgery or they get chemo first. But Herb?
So I think one of the analogies, to clarify, is probably better with rectal cancer and whether some modality should be done before or after surgery. And that really depends on the context, the patient, and quality of life considerations or surgical complication risks. And all of those variables are not completely worked out. The other variable in this is there any reason to think that chemo before surgery and chemo after surgery will be biologically very different? There's something special about big bulky tumors responding, or something about little itty-bitty residual disease being treated better. That is completely unknown. Once we get adjuvant data from stage 3, we may be able to make a better inference, but again, the biology of stage 3 and stage 4 disease may have minor differences. With that, what seems to be the hard decision nodal points are, if you can be resected with curative intent, that should be done. It should be done by a skilled surgeon because the biggest variable is morbidity and mortality of the procedure, of which the biggest variable is the skill of the surgeon. Surgery plus chemotherapy is better than surgery alone. How to give chemo, what duration, not worked out, although pre-op tends to be hard to give for these liver issues beyond 4 to 6 months. However, in the rare patient who will have gone through an algorithm of lots of chemo and then finally converts in a slow, zigzagging kind of way to potentially resectable, the issue of whether or not that patient should go to surgery should be made on a case-by-case basis, because once you get to the potential for surgery, your cure rate is still going to be significant. It might be 10%, might be 20 to 30%, but even in the worst case of 10%, that really is balanced against what's the chance of morbidity and mortality of the procedure. Then the next variable is, what's the best chemo? Since I think any discussions related to one treatment being better for metastatic versus another, I would take what's the most active, best tolerated systemic therapy, and that's what gets plugged in to however you're going to treat the patient, whether you have a neoadjuvant approach or whether you have a post-surgical approach.
So do you generally use neoadjuvant therapy in patients who are already resectable or just send them to surgery?
Personally, I think since I think the biology of benefit from treatment is going to be similar pre and post, there's a big practical advantage to resecting the patient initially, letting them heal up, and then potentially dealing with any residual disease afterward. So if they're de novo resectable, tend to refer to a surgeon. And then other little variables, patient preference, wedding events, surgeon's vacation schedule, location of lesions, other variables which start to become modest variables for how that patient gets managed, but always try to get that surgical opinion early.
Charlie?
I echo what everyone said. There's so many variables in play here in terms of disease for interval, prior therapy, the nature of the metastases in terms of making the decision. In my own practice, if somebody has certainly an isolated met with a reasonable disease for interval, I'll be happy to have the surgeon resect and give them postoperative therapy. But one other point that I'd like to make is we talked about the pros and cons of registries, prospective observational studies, and certainly the bone marrow transplanters for a long time were doing this, just collecting data with all the various ways they were transplanting patients. Why aren't we doing this with liver resections? Because I think the value of a prospective observational cohort study is when you recognize you're never going to be able to do a trial, then try to get data.
It is being done, I think.
It's done already.
It's being done in Europe.
There are thousands of patients entered into it. The same people who wrote the review.
Have they presented that data yet? I know they're collecting it.
They have presented it.
Parts of it.
Parts of it.
But John Primrose and a couple of other docs in Europe have done it. And anybody can enter the registry.
I want to just get a comment from Axel. And then, Dan, I want you to follow up on the case.
Okay, just a case that I had, just highlighting why I think neoadjuvant therapy, even resectable metastasis, can actually guide your treatment decision. I had a patient, young guy, 42 years old, who had not the perfect situation, only one lobe affected, but 4 liver metastases in the right lobe and 1 potentially resectable in the left lobe. So when I talked to our surgeon, this is resectable. We started, because it was not as straightforward, but in good hands, resectable. Started with FOLFOX bevacizumab, very short. I only wanted to 3 cycles, see, does it respond? Tumor grew. Tumor didn't respond. Tumor was actually larger. And clearly larger, no doubt about that, FOLFOX bevacizumab. So we tested the tumor for KRAS, and it was wild type, so we switched to FOLFIRI cetuximab. I wanted to see some response to see what do I do afterwards. I mean, if we had resected this patient beforehand, it could have been resected, had given the kind of standard therapy, FOLFOX bevacizumab, 12 cycles, would have potentially given inactive chemotherapy. We had a great response on FOLFIRI cetuximab after 3 cycles. Really dramatic response. Metastasis still visible. He gets post-operative FOLFIRI cetuximab right now.
Interesting. Dan, final comment. Can you tell us what happened to the patient? The
patient actually got resected 50-50. Two of the lesions had small amounts of viable tumor, two did not, and the patient elected no more therapy at that point. I elucidated some options, including an irinotecan-based regimen, 5-FU alone or nothing, and he chose nothing. And I think that was not inappropriate. And
what's his current status?
Still with us. It's about
2 years. How long
afterwards?
2 years later? Interesting.
Just one other comment. I think Neil's work on circulating tumor cells, this might be the perfect population to test the question of could you have predicted who was going to do well and who wouldn't. I mean, to me, I wonder if you might not find a cut point of who we're going to cure and who we're not with that intervention.
Dan, another recent data set we wanted to throw out to the group was the Cairo 2 ASCO sort of disappointing paper looking at chemo, bev, cetuximab in metastatic disease. This follows the prior PACE study also reporting disappointing results with chemo and double biologic therapy. In that case, panitumumab and bev. Dan, what's your take on this?
In brief, the Cairo 2 trial did a number of things. One is it showed American oncologists, I think, how efficient some countries can do clinical trials, because this was a very large trial done in the Netherlands addressing what was thought to be a very important question and is, which is, was the BOND 2 trial correct that adding bevacizumab and cetuximab together was a good thing? And we'll hear about the PACE trial in a moment using a different EGFR agent. But the Cairo 2 trial was a simple first-line study comparing CAPOX plus bevacizumab with or without cetuximab. And the results are somewhat superimposable to the PACE trial, except it didn't show more toxicity in terms of chemotherapy, which was seen in the PACE trial, which was potentially an explanation why more was not better than less therapy. But it did, in fact, show that the people who got dual antibodies did worse. And the exact cause of it is not clear, whether there's a negative synergy, which we can discuss. It didn't appear to be a toxicity issue, at least as reported in the abstract. Importantly, it was an elegantly presented study where they did not perform salami science. They not only presented the clinical data, but they were able to present the KRAS data as well, and once again showed that the group that appeared to benefit from the cetuximab were clearly the KRAS mutant wild-type patients. So I think there were two big take-home messages from there, furthering the KRAS story and also the concept that dual antibodies, for whatever reasons, probably multiples, are no better than a single antibody used alone.
I think what's most sobering about Cairo 2 is the fact that even the wild types don't demonstrate a benefit for double antibodies.
And I think one of the key issues we have to keep in mind is Cairo 2 omitted oxaliplatin after 6 cycles. So in a way, the effect you saw on overall survival, progression-free survival, long-term, whatever, was in the context of CAPE-BEV versus CAPE-BEV cetuximab. We talk about, you know, oxaliplatin, irinotecan, plus-minus cetuximab, where there is some differential interaction. But this was, in the end, after 6 months, was CAPE-BEV versus CAPE-BEV cetuximab.
Jordan, can you talk about what your take was from the PACE study, summarize the bottom line of what they looked at and what they reported?
Well, the PACE study was similarly designed that it was actually designed as a dealer's choice, so to speak, in terms of the chemotherapy, FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, with an anticipation that they were going to get about 80% FOLFOX and 20% FOLFIRI patients. They actually got more and closed the FOLFOX arm before the FOLFIRI arm was closed. Those patients were all given bevacizumab and then randomized to with or without panitumumab. So it was chemotherapy plus bevacizumab with or without panitumumab. And the primary analysis was really based around the FOLFOX data. And in that group, there was initially, we actually had a series of press releases. Press release one was that there was excess toxicity on the combined antibody arm. And then secondarily, there was an analysis that efficacy was worse on the combined arm. And on this presentation, this was updated data. They also presented the FOLFIRI data. It was interesting because the FOLFOX data, there was clearly harm, at least, you know, in the patients with KRAS mutation for getting the combined antibodies, the panitumumab and the bevacizumab in combination with chemo. In the FOLFIRI arm, there wasn't clearly the detriment, although there wasn't any benefit to combining the two. I think with both the Cairo 2 and the PACE trials, they were trials that needed to be done, needed to be seen. We needed to get those results to know what to do. But the best thing that can be said in terms of the results was at least they didn't hurt the patients who were wild type. That's the amazing thing.
Rich, what are your thoughts about the implications of these two data sets, both in terms of daily patient care, but maybe more importantly in terms of future clinical research?
Well, I think it's clear that the KRAS data is important, and as we discussed this morning, have already started using that in clinical practice as well as in clinical trials. I also think that outside the confines of a clinical trial, dual antibody treatment should not be done until we have a better understanding about this.
Dual antibody alone or with chemo or both?
With chemo. You know, I've occasionally used dual antibody treatment, and I'll give you an example of a patient that has a myelodysplastic syndrome. You know, a couple doses of oxali and the platelet count was 30,000, but 9 or 10 months of Bev plus cetuximab in that circumstance with a great response to treatment. So I wouldn't rule it out entirely, and we do have the data from the Bond 2 that gives us some support for using it, but I mean using it in first line with combination chemotherapy, as was done both with PACE and with Cairo-2.
There may be a lot of complexity related to the duration of treatment, tolerability of the regimen, including tolerance of oxaliplatin, tolerance of the EGFR antibody, and particularly both together may make any treatment endpoint after 6 months very hard to see because of dropout rates. And how we tend to collect toxicity information tends not to accurately reflect exactly the patient's experience. We don't do a good job of how to integrate multiple toxicities, how to integrate multiple moderate toxicity, like multiple grade 2 and a few grade 3, are very different than one isolated short-term ANC toxicity, and we don't do a good job. The same issue has to do with reasons for coming off of a study tend to be very poorly captured in the context of trials, which means we don't have a great idea other than just good clinical impression of why people need to stop treatment. There may be an interaction that is antagonistic between the two, but there may be issues where that may apply in a time-dependent way that may influence the refractory setting of Bond versus the first-line setting, in addition to any chemo interaction on top of all of the above. And for that reason, I think outside of a clinical trial, probably both antibodies together are not generally appropriate.
What about sequential therapy in the adjuvant setting? Again, as in breast cancer, why couldn't you use FOLFOX-BEV, you know, assuming it's going to be positive, and then follow that in the KRAS wild with cetuximab?
That's very reasonable. I think that when the study was designed, there were actually three studies launched with basically the same question at the same time, because the mouse data and the Bond 2 data looked like this was going to be potentially a home run that justified the cost and everything else involved. And like many things, it turns out not to be the home run that was hoped for or expected. It's reasonable to ask the question, as Neil said, because if it had, and we actually probably need to wait to see all of the data. With that caveat from the two studies which have been reported, PACE and Cairo-2, you know, the likelihood of double antibodies in first-line therapy are probably not going to be a home run in unselected patients. The question of whether even in the wild type is debatable. But I think in practice, you can segregate what's an interesting question, what might apply in theory to one patient if we had a diagnostic which could predict it, is different from in generally limited or unselected patients what to do. And it may also be hard to extrapolate from what happens in breast cancer, lung cancer, the value of adding 2 becomes 3, 3 becomes 4 drugs, whether or not doublets are better than singlets for maintenance or even rotated therapies, probably going to have to do a lot with the disease, and a lot of that's probably going to have to be decided on a patient-by-patient basis, depending how they actually do on the treatment.
Jordan?
So I hate to bring in the practical, but I don't know how long it takes us as oncologists to learn a lesson. There is no situation in oncology where really piling on has really worked out. I even go to lymphoma, where piling on didn't work. You know, they did the promase cytobombs. They had so many letters in their names, they had to come up with new words, and it didn't beat CHOP. We continually do this. I mean, I had no problem with us looking at the, there was good reason and rationale for looking at the combined cetuximab, bevacizumab, or pantumab, bevacizumab data, but we do this over and over again. I think that there's got to be a limit with every situation
to how much you can throw into a human body before it just you just don't get good effect. The harm is worse than the benefit. And we've proven it over and over again, decade after decade. It's not something new.
Another ASCO paper we wanted to touch on was the safety data presented from the NSABP CO8 adjuvant study of FOLFOX Bev. Herb, I didn't really see any major red flags, did you?
There's nothing alarming. The data are relatively short-term, but by the same token, reflect a reasonable amount of time on treatment to be sure that something catastrophic is not happening. I think the biggest implication is the value of the studies will be successful or not primarily on their efficacy, that the amount of toxicity is unlikely to have a big difference for the type of disease-free survival endpoint. With respect to long-term safety, not known yet.
Lee, any thoughts on that? And also, what were your thoughts about the wound healing data there?
So this keeps coming back to a mechanism of action of bevacizumab, which is vasoconstriction. And then we've had bowel perforations in patients with advanced stage disease and ovarian cancer, et cetera. And it's always worried me that some of the bowel perforations could be due to the fact that you're having a direct impact on the tumor with chemotherapy in ovarian cancer and single agent. But it also worries me that you may have vasoconstriction and causing a little bit of bowel ischemia. Not enough to cause a bowel perforation, but enough to cause people to have a little crampy pain as if they would have diverticulitis or something. So that's the first thing that came to mind when Jordan mentioned that. In regards to the wound complications, I actually jotted that down because I thought it was quite interesting. And I remember Carmen talking about a number of hernias, which actually occurred throughout the entire incision. And oftentimes when we have hernias, especially in Texas for different reasons, but when we have hernias in our patients, it may be Swiss cheese type hernias, just some small focal areas. But when Carmen described this in his presentation, it was the entire wound. So even though patients had completed their surgery, I assume they waited 28 days until therapy was begun, patients are not done their wound healing. And the bevacizumab would stop continued wound healing or impair continued wound healing, and during the time of remodeling of the collagen, etc., that these wounds fell apart. Now, they didn't have eviscerations, but they had a number of large hernias which required operative repair. A small number of patients, but it all does go back to mechanism of action, impaired wound healing, possibly vasoconstriction for the abdominal pain. And sometimes, you know, we learn things from the lab and we take it to the clinic, and sometimes we learn things from the clinic and take it back to the lab. So we need to look at these observations and make some sense of it.
Axel?
Just having reviewed two papers actually recently in a surgical journal, there are increasing number of patients reported now, especially with rectal cancer, surgery, radiation, and then delayed, even in the metastatic setting, then bevacizumab use and local complications about half a year after the surgery and radiation was completed. So I agree. I mean, this is one of the ideas that wound healing is probably not done within 4 weeks, especially not in an area where you might have radiation, might have anatomically challenging situations. So this wound healing complication is definitely real. Where the pain comes from, I mean, when I listened to the presentation, I thought this is like an ischemia-like pain probably. That's why vasoconstriction could definitely play a role.
Alan?
I think the long-term toxicity seen in these patients is really going to be incredibly important. I think you may see a lot of hernias. Maybe the pain is tension on the wound, but not actual disruption of the layers of the muscles. I think the risk of cardiovascular disease 3 to 5 years down the road can't be dismissed. Very few people exist in this world who've had now we're seeing more of them, but a year of Avastin and then living 5 years later. There are now some people, but not a whole lot. And the other issue that was alluded to is, for whatever reason, presumably investigator bias, the patients on Bev got more oxaliplatin. And unfortunately, it could muddy the interpretation of the data if there is a difference. Probably not. But for whatever reason, there was a bias amongst investigators to give more oxali to the patients on the
Do you think investigators could tell who was on Bev?
I don't think it was blinded. It wasn't blinded.
No way it was not blinded.
Because they went on for a year, and there was no way they were going to make people come back for a placebo for 6 months.
That's not blinded. Right.
So it was not blinded. So yes is the answer. But
let's go into your case, Rich.
Okay, so this is somebody I saw about a month ago, a 43-year-old man who presented with microcytic anemia after becoming incredibly short of breath and having extreme fatigue. Does have a family history that would meet the requirement for the Bethesda criteria for screening for Lynch syndrome. His mother had colon cancer at the age of 53, and her mother had it at the age of 58. He has a right-sided colonic mass on colonoscopy and has a laparoscopic colectomy. At pathology review, he has a 4-centimeter poorly differentiated tumor with lymphocytic infiltration. So the pathologist says, I think this looks like a Lynch syndrome tumor, and he has 18 negative lymph nodes. So the question in this case is, should you do anything more before you make a recommendation as to whether this young man should have adjuvant chemotherapy? And what would you recommend to him? He came to me from another oncologist who had recommended that he have 6 months of FOLFOX.
Neil, how would you be thinking this through?
So the first question I ask myself in somebody with stage 2 colon cancer is, are they at, quote, average risk, or do they have some kind of clinical pathologic features or presentation feature related to increased risk? And this individual does not. So this is an average risk person based on the number of negative lymph nodes, no perforation at diagnosis, no obstruction at diagnosis. So in this patient population, what we know from level 1 randomized clinical trial data is that the addition of oxaliplatin is no better than 5-fluorouracil alone. So if I was going to entertain adjuvant therapy in this individual, it would be with a fluoropyrimidine alone. However, the question is, what is the most benefit this individual could get, or the likely benefit that this individual would get from a fluoropyrimidine? And it's certainly measured in small percents in terms of absolute benefit. Certainly, I would say less than 5% benefit, and maybe closer to 0% benefit in an average risk stage 2 patient. But
what would you tell this man his risk of relapse is without treatment?
Probably, I would say 20%. Perhaps maybe less, 15 maybe. There's another complicating factor in this patient related to his family history, because the vast majority of patients in the studies that Rich has discussed were people who had sporadic mismatch repair deficiency and not hereditary. So they were individuals that had hypermethylation of MLH1, almost certainly accounting for their defective mismatch repair. This individual is much more likely than your average person with defective mismatch repair to actually have a germline mutation accounting for this finding. And in terms of the pathogenesis of this individual's cancer, it may be because of a loss of MSH2 or MSH6 or MLH1. But the impact of those germline mutations and the pathway by which this person developed their colon cancer may impact the response to chemotherapy differently than if they had defective mismatch repair based on hypermethylation. I think it's an open question at this point.
So bottom line, what would you do, Neil?
In this person, I probably would recommend that they see a genetic counselor, and because they meet Amsterdam criteria for having Lynch syndrome or HNPCC, which are more stringent than the less stringent Bethesda criteria, I would be proposing that this individual goes directly to genetic testing rather than having an MSI test if I was just evaluating them for hereditary cancer. Now, there are nuances there because you might do immunohistochemistry of the tumor to see if they lost expression of MSH2 or MLH1, because that might guide what gene you sequence. But the basic idea is meets Amsterdam criteria, high risk for hereditary cancer, therefore do genotyping. So that's one issue. But that's not going to be done before you have to make this decision about adjuvant therapy. And on balance, because of the family, the strong family history, I would be inclined to recommend against adjuvant therapy in this individual.
Axel?
Normal risk stage 2 now is a fluoropyrimidine-based treatment decision, yes or no. And there are some patients who should not receive 5-FU, and we know the overall benefit is not like huge, but it makes it even more important to isolate or to identify those patients who should not receive 5-FU. I think this is where Dan Sargent's analysis actually can be helpful. Because if we now have evidence that there is at least the, talking about concept trial, you know, we might actually harm patients in an adjuvant setting, whatever mechanism is out there, we cannot ignore that. So I do use this data saying, okay, and I wouldn't complicate it with the germline versus, so I think MSI-high tumor should not be treated with 5-FU. Those patients have better prognosis anyway. They don't receive any chemotherapy.
So in talking about the Lynch syndrome and the genetics of colon cancer, from what I can figure out, these hereditary tumors and actually some sporadic tumors have so-called microsatellite instability, or MSI. And these tumors, although they look poorly differentiated, actually have a better prognosis and appear to benefit less from 5-FU-based chemotherapy. What's your take on that, Alan?
Of course, there's a clinical trial that this patient would be eligible for, E5202, yeah, which will largely, undoubtedly show MSI high. It yeah certainly looked with this history and all. And the stratification would be that this patient would not get any therapy, assuming that the patient's MSI high.
And just to go over the ECOG 5202 trial design, this is for patients with stage 2 colon cancer who are split up based on molecular markers into low and high risk groups. The low risk patients are put on observation alone, and the high risk are randomized to FOLFOX plus or minus Bev. How's the accrual going on that study?
I think very well.
Yeah. It was slow starting, but it's picked up nicely. So I will tell you that this patient did have immunohistochemistry done and did not have expression of MLH1. And so at that point, I made a recommendation against adjuvant chemotherapy and just for follow-up for him. And now he's having his peripheral blood mononuclear cells genotyped to see if this is a germline mutation or an acquired mutation.
Charlie?
You know, akin to Neil's point, to complicate matters, it's very likely that MSI is not one thing, but it's probably a mix of specific phenotypes. And the HNPCC element is certainly one, but there's probably others. And the other relevant thing is actually BRAF, which is actually highly correlated with MSI, which is curious because BRAF predicts a far worse outcome, and yet it's commonly associated with MSI. And so MSI-high tumors that are BRAF mutated may be very different than those that are BRAF wild type. And what we obviously, I think we really need to see your studies where people characterize both MSI and BRAF in a patient population that are being treated.
So a typical algorithm for somebody who doesn't have a family history this strong for HNPCC would be to first do microsatellite instability testing and or immunohistochemistry for mismatch repair protein expression. And if it's MLH1 that is absent on immunohistochemistry, then rather than going to genotyping in those individuals, many centers are now recommending BRAF testing because there's a specific BRAF mutation that is associated with hypermethylation. And if you have that BRAF mutation, then you almost certainly do not have a germline mutation in MLH1. So that's a way to save money on genotyping.
Neil, I keep hoping what happened in breast cancer with the Oncotype assay is also going to happen in colorectal cancer because it really made a big impact on practice. Can you talk a little bit about the work Mike O'Connell first reported at ASCO 2006 and then at the 2008 meeting on the NSABP's attempts to find an RT-PCR assay like Oncotype for colon cancer?
These two papers are about development of a classifier of prediction and prognosis in stage 2 colon cancer. In order to develop a classifier, you need an assay technology that is stable, reliable, and reproducible. You need patient samples from a population that is well characterized in terms of their clinical outcomes, and that's usually from previous clinical trial. You'd like to have available samples that are representative of the overall population in that study, so you know these patients are representative of the overall population. And you start out by using a subset of the samples as a training set, and then you need to validate on another independent sample to reduce the false positive rate as you're trying to identify a new classifier, a new marker. Then once you have an idea about what that marker might be that you want to then test to prove that it should be used in routine clinical care, you then need to do a validation study. So the actual discovery aspect is a long and arduous process that needs to be carefully done before you even get to the point where you can validate a new classifier. So in these two studies, patients with stage 2 colon cancer had their tumors interrogated to try and identify a gene expression profile that was associated with their prognosis or their response to 5-FU therapy. In the first study, samples from NSABP C01 and C02 studies who were in either the surgery-only arm or the surgery plus BCG arm were looked at.
And expression profiling for 757 genes was measured using RT-PCR, and this was done in paraffin-embedded tissue, which is key because that's what we generally have access to. And there was an association of 142 genes with relapse-free survival. This is important because in a single study from a single set like this, one would expect that about a quarter of these genes were actually false positives. So you need to go on to another study. And that's what they reported 2 years later in a so-called gene refinement study, in which they looked at another group of patients. These were patients from NSABP-C06 who were in the arm of that study that received 5-FU plus leucovorin. There were 508 patients that were explored in this analysis. And again, a large number of genes were interrogated for their levels of expression. 375 genes were looked at, and there were 169 of those genes that were associated with either shorter or longer relapse-free interval. And 56 of these genes, so about a third of the genes identified, were also significant in the patient set from C01 and C02, and another independent patient set from the Cleveland Clinic. So in this particular analysis, there was a gene discovery statistical analysis done from NSABP-C06, and then what was found there was applied to these other data sets from C01, C02, and the Cleveland Clinic population. And there were 56 genes whose expression was predictive in all three of these. Now, because one of the studies had chemotherapy in it, and three of the studies did not, or three of the data sets did not, they were able to do an interaction analysis between expression of genes and treatment. And 69 genes showed a significant interaction, suggesting that there might be a profile that could be generated for prognosis and a profile for prediction using these data. And just as sort of an initial exploration into developing a gene expression prognostic model, they showed that they could develop a model where they could group the patients in C01 and C02 into three different patient groups based on gene expression using an algorithm with multiple genes that stratified these three groups based on the likelihood of recurrence, with the lowest recurrence risk group being 5% risk of recurrence at 5 years, the middle group being an 18% risk of recurrence, and the high-risk group being a 27% risk of recurrence, suggesting that gene expression profiling for stage 2 colon cancer might help us one day, were these results or those like these to be validated, to identify a patient subset that certainly would not need therapy, that is to say only a 5% risk of relapse, and a group that would almost certainly be offered therapy if there was therapy of benefit, namely 27% risk of relapse. These studies are really a great example of collaborations between academia and industry, and these are the types of collaborations that are absolutely critical in the name of improving the care of our patients.
What do we know about the timeline moving forward here in terms of the NSABP work and when we're going to see some more data?
I think the timeline is short because one of the advantages of having a commercial partner is that there are timelines that are very important. And so it wouldn't surprise me if in the next year we see publications related to these data and perhaps greater refinement of the profiling algorithms and more data with regard to how this might be used.
Alan?
I agree. I think the dilemma, as Axel says in his last note, is prognosis is one issue and the predictive value of what the interaction with treatment will be is another issue. That's a whole other issue. But I think I would argue that this may very well identify the patients who absolutely don't need chemotherapy. And perhaps just like maybe MSI does the same thing. Then the issue is how do you validate this prospectively? And with Oncotype DX, I know there's this ornate breast cancer trial, which will probably take half a century to complete.
TAILORx.
Right.
But, you know, it's interesting. In TAILORx, actually, a lot of those patients have their treatment already defined by the Oncotype.
Right.
It's only intermediate that
right.
actually get randomized.
Right. And so, in any case, I think that the downstream, what you do with the results, but my sense is that we'll have some of this data pretty soon. The problem, of course, moving forward is that they've exhausted the subsets of untreated patients with stage 2 disease, and then you mix and match the other treatments we're offering. The predictive value of predictive is a different question.
Rich?
But actually, there is one other large data set, and that's a CLGB17-1A monoclonal antibody, where placebo. It turns out patients were essentially randomized to placebo versus nothing. And so there is an untreated data set of about 2,100 patients on which we have blocks from about 1,800 patients. And the plan is to run the blocks through the GHI assay to see.
And we'll also have the untreated population on 5202, albeit a pre-selected group of patients.
No, my point is that this may conclusively show us who doesn't need to be treated. The issue is the interaction with treatment in the patients who have the less favorable profile is going to be a whole different question.
And it's interesting, in breast cancer, you know, they presented data last December for the first time in node-positive patients, similar kinds of approach with a retrospective look at a prospective trial. And it was interesting because the relapse rate was fairly high, as you can imagine, node-positive patients. There were issues about the events they were looking at. But in spite of that, they did not see a benefit of chemotherapy in the patients with low recurrence score and did in the high recurrence score. Rich, do you think that that possibility is down the line in terms of colon cancer, actually predictive in terms of response to systemic therapy?
I hope so.
Any evidence right now that we have about that, Neil?
About response to therapy?
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, in these two presentations, Mike O'Connell showed some very preliminary, sort of meant to be tantalizing algorithms for stratification of groups, but nothing really was ready for prime time at that point.
Rich?
So we actually have another paper that is under review at a prestigious but unnamed journal from the CALGB IFL trial, where we did MSI on patients and then looked at whether or not IFL benefited one subset more than 5-FU leucovorin. And it turns out for the patients with the microsatellite high tumors, mismatch repair defect, irinotecan was beneficial, while for the overall population and for the patients with the microsatellite stable tumors, irinotecan was not beneficial. So there may actually be a differential effect on tumors that arise through the microsatellite instability pathway of irinotecan, making that a predictive marker.
Why don't we just throw a case in here just to kind of get back off the beaten track? Actually, I want to present your case, Alan, and kind of get back to something we were talking about this morning.
So this is a 45-year-old woman who works at UCSF, and this is one of those cases where you get about 20 phone calls or emails before you've had a chance to see the patient. And a very bizarre presentation. I've never seen this otherwise. She presents with lactic acidosis. So she's tachypneic, really weak and fatigued, fevers, very ill, and jaundiced, and presents to the ED.
How long were the symptoms
this
in evolution?
This is about a month of symptoms. She works. She has two little kids. She just thought she was running out of steam. And then one of her kids actually mentioned that she was jaundiced. Mommy, why are your eyes yellow?
What was her pH?
Well, her pH was compensated, about 7.2. Her respiratory rate was about 50.
Wow.
And she actually gets admitted and is put on a bicarb drip to maintain her acid-base status. She gets worked up, has massive hepatic metastases with a cecal mass on CT scan. I've never seen lactic acidosis before, no matter how much tumor patients have. And we suspect that she had some sort of inborn error of metabolism that might have explained it. But I don't know what that's about. Her CEA was 3,700 on the first check, was actually went to about 8,000 over the couple of weeks she was in the hospital. So saw her in the hospital. This is one of the very few times I've ever given chemotherapy to a patient in the hospital. But she was on oxygen. She really was very sick. And palliative care had already seen her to talk about whether to do anything. And saw her, obviously, a young woman, we decided to treat her. And so the first issue was, what do we treat her with? And my view was that, on the one hand, you get one bite of the apple, so maybe you throw the book at her. On the other hand, I thought if we had any complications of therapy, that this was all she wrote. So what drugs can you use without concern in this patient? I went with FOLFOX and actually dosed her full dose FOLFOX. And then 10 days later, as soon as her counts came back, I gave her another dose of FOLFOX, just sort of flying by the seat of my pants. And she had resolution of her lactic acidosis, was discharged. within continued Folfox until she developed a neuropathy, at which time her CEA had fallen to 6 with a just phenomenal response in her liver. We actually took her back to colonoscopy at that time and couldn't find the cecal mass. And the question was, what do we do next? So I pointed this case out to demonstrate that you can get robust responses in patients just with chemotherapy, that you don't need to throw biologics in. There was a fair bit of yammering in my ear, why don't we give bevacizumab or something else? And I just felt that if this lady had a PE or some abdominal event, that was all she wrote. So, I mean, it's easy with the retrospectoscope to see that I did the right thing, but that was the debate. She's actually a nurse practitioner. So you want to talk about the barrage I got from people with other opinions.
What's the follow-up? What happened?
Yeah, so she is now 8 months out and doing clinically well, although this week she had a few new complaints. The question was, she developed neuropathy, so we stopped the Folfox. And the question that I addressed a couple of months ago with her is whether to give her a holiday. Very realistic, wants to go camping with her kids this summer, which is marvelous, great idea. And so one of the issues I was putting out is, do you put this patient, which I don't do routinely, on maintenance therapy? Do I actually give her an absolute vacation, or do I do something else? And that was the internal debate. As somebody who doesn't use maintenance therapy, you know, in this woman, what do you do?
Neil, how would you be thinking this through?
Well, I'm a treatment holiday guy. And in general, I look for ways to give people a complete treatment holiday with the recognition that the Optimox 2 study in an unselected population suggests that there might be a downside to not continuing some drugs all the time. So that said, in this patient who was deathly ill from a metabolic complication of cancer out of control, I would be concerned that this might be a person who I wouldn't catch her progression quickly enough, were she to progress, that I might actually recommend that this person remain on some kind of maintenance program.
Axel?
So I have similar cases, actually 2 or 3 without this lactate acidosis, but very kind of lot of tumor burden, deathly sick. So you need to do something. It's either or. And I agree with Alan did. I do give full dose Folfox because, you know, it's not, you can give full dose Folfox in patients with liver insufficiency, even with high bilirubin, that's not a problem. I would have probably added bevacizumab from cycle 2 on. Once you've kind of gained on this tumor, I would have not started with bevacizumab up front, but I would have added it from
cycle. To be clear, I actually had that discussion with her after 2 cycles when she was discharged, and her view was, you know, we're playing a winning hand right now. I just assume she's very realistic about her expectations.
I am a maintenance therapy guy, and you know, whether it's right or wrong, but I really acknowledge the approach. Holidays, you know, might play a role. I would have probably shared, in this particular case, Neil's concerns about if she goes untreated too long. I mean, this is a tumor that has high proliferative potential. Is this exactly what you eradicated, that you kind of cured the high proliferative?
Right. Do you leave a chronic disease behind?
You leave a chronic, you know, tumors are heterogeneous. So not all tumors are created equal, even within one body. But I would have probably, if this was presented to me, I would have said, put it on maintenance.
Dan?
I'm both a maintenance and a holiday guy, and I think it does depend on tumor bulk and the reason you're treating. I had the same question as after she responded to Folfox and was feeling good, since bevacizumab is not usually associated with a better response up front, but a longer time on response, I probably would have added bevacizumab at some point. And I would probably keep this patient on single agent fluoropyrimidine plus bevacizumab as a holiday.
All good minds run in the same gutter.
And my level 4 evidence is I spent a day with Amory de Grammont and his partners in clinic, and we had this long discussion. And these are not the kind of people that they give complete treatment breaks to, in part because of the Optimox 2 data. When they looked at the high bulk patients, their holidays were weekends.
So she's actually on capecitabine and Bev.
Capecitabine and Bev.
What I decided.
For how long?
Well, she's been on it for 3 months with stable disease. CEA inching up very slightly, but very pleased, out totally sort of divorced from us for a while. She's going camping with her kids next week. but I just couldn't imagine not keeping her on therapy.
Sorry, this is exactly what I think. I mean, you can still give patients a decent quality. Once you've titrated the right capecitabine dose,
right.
You can omit one dose of bevacizumab. Patients don't need to see every
She's actually three getting weeks. Every 3 weekly bev.
Or even every 6 weeks.
Right.
You know, you can give patients a holiday from coming and see you, which is probably the factor that improves their quality of life most, you know?
Any interest in trying to study patients like the two patients you've presented here as a separate group, even across tumor lines, in terms of seeing if you can...
Well, you know, in retrospect, obviously, why did this woman have such a dramatic response? I mean, I think our message is we would learn the most from taking the patients who are primary refractory and the patients who have these robust responses rather than the 90% of patients who fall within what we expect. But how do you study the patient? In other words, is it in vitro tumor assays, or I don't know how to do it. As I told Neil, this is a lady I would have loved to do the circulating tumor cells on, because that would have been upfront and then in a week or two would have been incredibly important, because we don't often treat patients where you better make your best guess the right guess, because that's the only shot you get at it. And so actually we thought about doing circulating tumor cells, but in this case her lactic acidosis disappeared, so we knew we were doing the right thing.
Charlie?
Related to what you're saying, I often think about exactly what you described, which is to look at the outliers. If we could generate a registry of the really, really good responders, the folks we've talked about this morning who are years out, and then regrettably those who progress within months, and say, we're going to do an exhaustive search. We're going to whole genome scan their germline DNA. We're going to look at a litany of mutational events in their tumors and look at expression arrays. Think of what we might learn.
Absolutely.
I agree. And the two outliers and comparative genomics, yeah.
Right.
That's what we need.
Rich?
So I think it's sort of interesting that we heard OptimOx presented 1 year and we're all optimistic that holidays were in. And then we heard it presented the next year, and the data was pretty compelling, leading Amory and his colleagues to change their plans, that holidays are out. And yet, I think most of us in this room still use holidays. And why do we do it?
Relative.
And I think that, in part, we believe that we can tease out who can get away with a holiday and who cannot, and look at things like bulk of disease. And, you know, we have many patients who have 11 small liver nodules and 2 lymph nodes in their abdomen whose bulk of disease doesn't add up to much if you put it in a bowl. And then we have patients like this one whose liver is failing because they have lots and lots of bulky disease. And I think we kind of do these algorithms in our head saying, I think I can get away with it in this patient. And, you know, I saw a patient last week who I've been doing, you know, 3 or 4 months a year treatment holidays for 5 years. CEA goes up, liver mets get bigger, start them on treatment, they go down, he gets sick of the toxicity, we stop, you know, we have this stuttering. So far I've gotten away with it, and his treatment holidays are really wonderful for him.
Let's finish out this discussion with some comments about rectal cancer. This past year was a bit dry in terms of major papers or presentations, but Dan, what are the key research questions out there on the table on this disease?
Certainly the next question is the one you raised with R04. Can you routinely substitute capecitabine for 5-FU, and does oxaliplatin add? The phase 1-2 data would suggest that there's a possibility that both questions will be answered in the positive, that yes, you can use capecitabine, and yes, probably oxaliplatin will at least have an effect on path CR rate. I think what that will do is move us forward. If that is indeed prognostic, it moves us forward in designing the next set of studies without waiting for 5-year overall survival. It may be the equivalent of 3-year DFS and overall survival. Of the two biologics, Lee can address this further. I somehow get a little anxious about the thought of a VEGF drug plus radiation where the late effects are primarily on the vessels, and I don't know preclinical data to suggest a synergy. For cetuximab, there might be more of a rationale. So our phase 2 study at our own institution is neoadjuvant CAPOX plus cetuximab for 2 cycles while the radiation oncologists are revving up their machines. And nobody has progressed through that treatment, as in the MRC study, without cetuximab. They then get radiation and chemotherapy and cetuximab together. We don't have enough patients to comment, but Heinz Lenz is actually doing biomarkers on tissue. And the big problem is we don't have post-treatment tissue in the vast majority of patients to look at changes, because most of the people are having path CRs or very minimal disease.
Would you expect KRAS to be relevant, or maybe this is different because it's synergy with radiation therapy?
We're having that discussion. There are small amounts of data to suggest that KRAS mutational status does not affect any radiosensitizing effects of cetuximab with radiation, but we did put the study on hold for the neo-radiation chemotherapy component.
Actually, we were talking about cetuximab radiation last week in the lung think tank in terms of locally advanced disease. A lot of interest in looking at that in a trial. Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to think about what the goal of improved local response, local results are with rectal cancer in setting the bar for clinical trials. And I wholly agree with you, Lee, that the bar for making a go, no-go decision with regard to going on to a phase 3 study for complete pathologic response in rectal cancer has to be very high. And the reason we're trying to improve local control is ultimately we'd like to have more organ-sparing treatment. So you'd like to cure people without requiring surgery in rectal cancer. And so we need to set the bar very high in terms of what we will demand from a new intervention to improve local control. And so I agree, 40%, 50%, you know, we're going to have to get up there in order to really feel that we're moving forward. Because the 1 month of additional systemic therapy that you're getting during radiation is not likely going to have a huge impact on distant metastases. So we're really focusing on local control and why.
The question that I think I get most often, and probably most people here do, if in patients who get neoadjuvant chemotherapy, whatever the regimen they got, do they need postoperative adjuvant chemotherapy? It's probably the most asked question. Based on pathologic CR, should they get no therapy, the same therapy, or even more therapy as in E5204, which is a FOLFOX question? And I think, unfortunately, the French trial published in the New England Journal of Medicine is somewhat misleading in that I think it was underpowered, and a lot of patients never got the chemotherapy they were supposed to get. So people use that as an excuse not to give treatment. And when they quote the German study, they sometimes forget the part that all patients got a full 6 months of chemotherapy, including the neoadjuvant group that got chemo after. So I think it's a good research question that if it were come to pass, for example, that a fluoropyrimidine oxaliplatin radiation platform was a standard neoadjuvant, if they had a path CR, do you continue that? Do you need to continue treatment? And if they don't, should they flip to a different treatment regimen, perhaps CPT-11 cetuximab? Just a big question.
Axel?
So 2 points to that. First of all, I do think that a path CR rate actually underscores the treatment sensitivity of the cancer. And looking at the effect of systemic chemotherapy afterwards, which has a very different goal, meaning preventing systemic recurrence, actually there is a good rationale for doing that. And in the contrary, if those tumors had not responded at all, would they be chemosensitive to begin with? Actually, the MRC had data on CAPOX as induction therapy followed by radiochemotherapy, and they reported with their CAPOX a 96% response rate. I think this was in JCO some time ago, with toxicities and complications, but they had a huge response rate on the primary tumor.
That's without the radiation?
Without radiation. So in some ways, and I'm wondering whether this is a kind of venue where we could actually study the biologic effects of our therapy very easily, because it's easier to get a rectal biopsy. And this is similar to what Chris Willett did in terms of we have an easily accessible tumor. So let's study what's happening by using just our systemic chemotherapy. And, of course, keep in mind that at some point we want to emphasize local control and then do the radiation therapy. Similar to the idea that I think is more en vogue right now in esophageal cancer, where it's also easy to get sequential biopsies before treatment, on treatment, etc.
So does anybody envision a day where you could do a trial with optimal chemotherapy and see if you get a response and get rid of radiation therapy for certain rectal tumors? Because we've seen a number of marked responses. Now, we didn't see this patient until he completed his chemotherapy, but at the end of his therapy, when his hydronephrosis went away and he was doing well, could he have been resected then and never receive radiation therapy at all?
So your question is not excluding surgery, but excluding radiation.
Right. Akasag had proposed a study like that a few years ago, didn't they?
Yeah.
I think they did. You know, I think the question comes to mind is, do we start differentiating them low, middle, or high? That's a big issue that comes from the German trial, and that really the benefit in terms of the neoadjuvant chemo radiation, in terms of ostomy rate was really in this one group that was really middle. The high rectals, it's not as clear as it used to be that those patients really should get the radiation. We don't have strong enough data one way or another. But, you know, when you look at it, you look all the way back to, what was it, R02, where they looked at chemo versus chemo radiation. 7 out of every 100 patients who got the chemo radiation actually benefited from the radiation portion. That was the local control difference, was 13% versus 6% or something like that. And so we are treating a heck of a lot of people with radiation, and we probably do need to start looking at that question as a next step.
Neil, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think there are two issues. One issue is we have the potential for improved systemic therapy, which will improve the local control rate, but we also have the potential for new technologies in terms of radiation delivery that will decrease the morbidity, acute and chronic, related to radiation. So it may be somewhat of a moot point as radiation therapy becomes less toxic. But if we have more effective systemic therapy and improve the complete response rate, we might be able to avoid radiation, but even more importantly, might be able to one day avoid surgery for rectal cancer if we can make this look more like anal canal cancer.
Dan?
Just the point that was made in terms of the high T3N0 patient by clinical staging, we obviously need better clinical staging. Because in the German trial, of the people who went immediately to surgery who would have thought to have needed radiation therapy, 20%. I think it was 20% of patients roughly had stage 0 or 1 disease, not even counting low 2s. So right there, we're over-treating 20% of people with radiation, which has long-term toxicities, no matter in which direction you give it. So in our institution, and probably in many others, if it's someone has not a poorly differentiated tumor, and by a good EUS, an MRI shows a T3N0 lesion, which might even be a T2, we usually take that person to an LAR and only do radiation in the subset of people who are at high risk for local failure.